With humpbacks is why do they sing?
Join me, Hannah Fry, on 10 extraordinary adventures of data and discovery on BBC Sounds and Radio 4 next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 6th of September. This is Today with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson.
The headlines this morning. The Home Secretary will chair talks today on destroying the gangs smuggling people across the Channel, days after 12 people died trying to reach the UK, and as we hear of the grave risks others face.
I heard a mayday put out on the radio from a Border Force vessel saying that the dinghy had broke up and there was over 50 people in the water.
Climate scientists say 2024 is on track to be the hottest year ever, with a string of records broken over the summer.
Also in today's programme, we'll hear from the UK's new chief scout, Dwayne Fields, who grew up on an inner-city estate and turned away, in his words, from a life of weed, cocaine and guns to walk to the North Pole. Former Prime Minister Sir John Major tells Gary about his concerns about the future of cricket at county level.
Is being forced to the fringes of the cricket season by the short form of the game, because the short form is so popular. But I worry that the county game is the natural route to Test cricket. And I worry too about the future of Test cricket.
And a quartet who met at the Leeds Conservatoire, indie band English Teacher, have won the Mercury Prize. One of the judges, Jamie Cullum, will join us to tell us why. That's all after the BBC News read this morning by Alan Smith.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, will chair a meeting of senior ministers, intelligence agencies and law enforcement bodies today to discuss what progress has been made in tackling criminal gangs who smuggle people across the Channel. 12 people died on Tuesday when their small boat came apart off the French coast. Ms. Cooper said this showed the moral imperative of dismantling the gangs. Our Home Editor Mark Easton reports.
More than 7,000 migrants have arrived in Britain after attempting to cross the Channel in small boats since the election. But the government believes progress is being made in disrupting the gangs which organise the crossings. The Home Office says the tragedy off the French coast on Tuesday is evidence that the business model of the smugglers is under pressure. More people are being crammed into less seaworthy vessels, with intelligence suggesting the gangs have increased their charges, including demanding payment for children. Ms. Cooper will today highlight significant seizures of boats and equipment in the last 2 months and 70 ongoing investigations, including an operation in Libya in which warehouses holding migrants were raided. However, after promising the rapid recruitment of a border security commander to oversee the response 2 months ago, Downing Street has said the appointment will be confirmed in the next few weeks.
The European Union's climate monitor, Copernicus, has said that during the past 3 months, the world experienced the hottest June and August ever recorded, as well as the hottest day. The agency said that the summer in the Northern Hemisphere also set a new high, beating last year, and that the string of broken records suggested 2024 would surpass the benchmark for the hottest year. The rising temperatures were made worse by the weather phenomenon known as El Niño. But Carlo Buontempo, the director of Copernicus, said man-made climate change was the main cause.
This was the warmest August and the warmest summer on record globally. And this is happening in a moment where El Niño is no longer the main driver. And of the many drivers of climate variability, the one we need to look into in this case as a main responsible is really anthropogenic climate change and the increase in greenhouse gases in our atmosphere.
A former boss at a cladding company who was heavily criticised in the Grenfell Tower inquiry has denied playing a part in the disaster. Claude Verler, who worked at Arconic, refused to give evidence in person to the inquiry, but his name appears in its report more than 100 times. The details from Tom Simons.
Claude Verler was head of the technical sales support team at the manufacturer Arconic. The inquiry report said he resorted to deliberate dishonesty to sell its Rayner Bond cladding, including to firms in the UK. He had emailed colleagues in 2010 saying the product would not meet European fire standards for tall buildings, adding, we have to keep as very confidential. Near his home in eastern France, he was asked by BBC News to give his reaction to the inquiry's report. He called the deaths of 72 Grenfell victims a tragedy and more than a pity, but he said he was not the one making the decisions about the sales of flammable Rainerbond PE cladding.
President Zelensky will press Ukraine's allies for more military support at a meeting at Ramstein Air Base in Germany this morning. Britain has promised to provide hundreds more short-range air defence missiles. Here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
This is the 24th meeting of the US-led Ramstein Group, which includes dozens of Ukraine's allies. President Zelensky is expected to attend this one in person. He's still trying to persuade allies to give Ukraine permission to use Western-supplied long-range missiles to hit targets inside Russia. Ukraine's president has also appealed for more air defence systems, with Russia stepping up its own strikes in recent days. Britain says it will send an additional 650 shorter-range missiles as part of a new military aid package worth £160 million.
President Biden's son Hunter has pleaded guilty to tax fraud. He'd been about to stand trial in Los Angeles but changed his plea at the last minute. Prosecutors had accused him of failing to pay at least $1.4 million in taxes and instead spending money on drugs, sex workers and a lavish lifestyle. The 54-year-old could face up to 17 years in prison when he's sentenced in December. In a statement, Hunter Biden said he did not want to subject his family to the pain of a trial. His lawyers said he was keeping open all options, including a possible appeal. And the Leeds-based indie band English Teacher have won this year's Mercury Prize for the best album by a British or Irish act. The judges said the record, called This Could Be Texas, stood out for its originality and depth. It's the first time a band from outside London has been awarded the Mercury Prize since 2014.
Quite right too, Alan Smith. Thank you very much indeed. It's coming to 7 minutes past six. Time for our first look at the morning weather with Staff Danaeus at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Staff.
Good morning to you, Nick and Michelle. Thank you very much. Similar weather today than what we had yesterday. It's a three-way split across the UK. So I'll start with southern parts. That's most of southern England into South Wales, the South Midlands and perhaps as far north as Suffolk. Here we're going to continue to stay very humid. There will be showers and thunderstorms. Already we've got some thunderstorms and showers pushing into the southeast of England as I speak. And this likely to extend across more western areas of southern England as well as we head through the day. And like yesterday, we could see some localised flooding, some thunder and lightning. And we have a Met Office yellow warning for rain for southern England and southeast Wales. That's valid throughout the whole day. Further north, though, it's a much quieter story. It is warm and humid across the whole country, but we've got plenty of sunshine for western Scotland, Northern Ireland, northwest England, and into parts of the northwest Midlands and North Wales. So a decent day for you with long spells of sunshine and feeling warm. Where we have the easterly breeze, though, that's going to feed in a lot of cloud across either eastern side of the UK. So for the Northern Isles, eastern Scotland, northeast and eastern England here, it'll stay rather grey with extensive fog, particularly close to the coast, and quite breezy at times. That'll suppress temperatures. We're looking at the high teens, low 20s along the North Sea coast. Across the south of the country, we have the showers and storms around 17 to 19 degrees. But in the northwest of the UK, we have the sunshine, particularly northwest England, western Scotland. We're looking at 24 to 27 Celsius. That's your forecast.
Stav, thank you very much. 8 minutes past six. Let's have a look here at the morning's papers and news websites. The Daily Telegraph leads with a report that British criminals could serve their time in jails in Estonia under plans being considered by ministers to ease Britain's overcrowded prisons. It says the Baltic state has plenty of empty cells it wants to rent out, and government sources are quoted as saying all viable options were being considered. While the UK system is on the brink of collapse, the paper expected discussions to have taken place between ministers yesterday, but says the Prison Reform Trust has called the idea half-baked.
The Rwanda plan is backed, according to the Daily Mail, but it explains that the option to send illegal migrants to the African country is now being considered by Germany using the facilities that Britain paid for. The German Migration Commissioner, Joachim Stamp, said that the scheme could target refugees crossing the European Union's eastern border. The Tory leadership contender Robert Jenrick tells the paper that the Labour government's decision looks more foolish by the day, but Downing Street insisted the Rwanda scheme was a gimmick.
The Grenfell Inquiry report continues to make headlines. The Times says the architecture firm, which was behind the refit of the tower, has been prevented from closing down while investigations into the disaster continue, despite being in liquidation for 4 years. It points out that the public inquiry said Studio E bore a very significant degree of responsibility because of the choice of materials used and because of its cavalier attitude to safety. The Guardian quotes a warning from the former chief prosecutor that justice for the 72 deaths may not come before the end of the decade. Lord MacDonald tells the paper the creaking justice system means any criminal trials may not begin before 2029.
According to the Scottish Daily Mail, detectives have submitted the findings of their investigation to Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP's finances to prosecutors. It says police have made a formal request to the Crown Office asking what action to take next. Ms Sturgeon insists she's done nothing wrong.
The Eye reports the introduction of post-Brexit checks on imported fruit and vegetables from the EU are set to be delayed again because of fears they will push up food prices in the UK. It says the government wants to put off the new controls until July next year. The checks have already been moved back from next month until January.
The Times reports on medical evidence that backs up the traditional remedy of a salt water gargle to help cure coughs and colds in children. It says a scientific study has found that a homemade saline solution used as nasal drops could decrease the length of a childhood cold by 2 days. It also lowered the risk of passing on the infection.
And the Daily Mirror says a monument to honour the late Queen Elizabeth is to be built in St James's Park in London. The paper says an announcement is due this weekend, which coincides with the second anniversary of her death on the 8th of September. It expects the finished sculpture to be unveiled in 2026.
It is now 11 minutes past six. The number of migrants who've crossed the Channel looks set to top 1,000 this week and shows no sign of slowing, despite the deaths of 12 people earlier in the week. Simon Jones is our reporter on the coast this morning. Morning to you, Simon. Business as usual, it seems.
Yeah, so far this week we've had 965 people making the crossing and conditions are set to be good over the coming days, so it's clear that that number is going to rise. And it brings the total so far this year to almost 22,000 people. Now, the mantra of the previous government was stop the boats, but we've seen a shift since Labour have come to power. They're talking about smashing the gangs, even today talking about destroying the gangs. Now, that comes after 12 people lost their lives in the Channel on Tuesday. I was speaking to a local fisherman, Matt Coker, who's been out on the water quite a lot this week, and he told me that on Monday, so the day before the tragedy, he saw another boat break apart and 50 people end up in the water. It was lucky on that occasion that everyone was safely rescued. But that's why we're having the Home Secretary today talking about a moral imperative to disrupt the supply of boat parts and engines to try to bring an end to these dangerous crossings.
And what is interesting is that a link is being made by officials between the success of intercepting boats and the boats that are then overcrowded sinking, because the smugglers are trying to shove more and more people onto the number of boats they still have got.
Yeah, the government is saying this morning that it reckons that the business model of the people smugglers packing people onto these dangerously overloaded boats is changing. And they're putting that down to some success they're claiming to have in disrupting the supply chain of boats. For example, they say that they've had a presence with the National Crime Agency in Bulgaria in recent weeks, and that has helped lead to the seizure of 40 boats and engines, which they reckon would have helped around 2,500 people make the crossing. So they're saying that the smugglers may be having more difficulty obtaining these boats. That means that the boats they have, they're packing more and more people onto them. And they even say they've got intelligence to say the smugglers are now charging people more to get on those boats and charging for children, when in the past children may have been able to go for free. But this task of smashing the criminal gangs, it is very difficult because it involves international cooperation. And one former head of the Border Force said it's a bit like a game of whack-a-mole. You take out one gang, another one quickly springs up, because this is such a lucrative trade in human misery.
Simon Jones, thank you. We're going to be talking to the Immigration Minister later in the programme.
14 minutes past six now. President Biden's son Hunter is facing a jail term that could possibly be up to 17 years. That's after he pleaded guilty to tax evasion. Our US correspondent Emma Vardy has been telling me about the case against him.
This all relates to a very chaotic period in Hunter Biden's life over several years when he was addicted to crack cocaine. And he's since documented that in a lot of detail. But during this chaotic period, he splurged a lot of money on a luxury lifestyle, on hotels, on strip clubs, on women, on luxury cars. And later on, it emerged that he had been writing some of these expenses off as tax expenses and therefore paid a lower tax bill as a result. Now, when all of this caught up with him, he then ended up facing these 9 charges of tax evasion, accused of underpaying $1.4 million of taxes, and therefore had to face this criminal trial, a second criminal trial that he would have faced this year, having previously been found guilty of obtaining a handgun illegally. But there was a dramatic turn of events today when, arriving at court, we were all expecting there to be this criminal trial. But instead, at the last minute, Hunter Biden's legal team, they said they were changing the plea. And in the end, he went for a guilty plea, which means the trial is now cancelled and he will simply face sentencing in December.
Could this affect the Democrats politically, even though his father is not running for re-election?
Well, it's always weighed very heavily on Joe Biden as US president, politically and personally. Although the stakes are a lot lower now that he's not going to be the Democratic candidate to run for a second term, his political opponents have always tried to link any alleged wrongdoing by Hunter Biden with Joe Biden, tries to cast a shadow over him, although there's never been any evidence emerged to suggest wrongdoing by Joe Biden. In particular, too, Republicans have tried to link an investigation into Hunter Biden's business dealings to allege wrongdoing by Joe Biden. But Joe Biden is no longer in the spotlight so much when it comes to the election. He's not the man that they're asking Americans to vote for as the next president again. So really, this doesn't have as much political clout for Joe Biden's opponents, albeit there's still a lot of interest because he is the first son of a sitting president ever to face criminal convictions.
Emma Vardy in the US, thank you.
16 minutes past six now. Lockers, where you pick up or drop off parcels for collection and delivery, have become one of the new battlegrounds in retail. We get a snapshot of how popular or not they are this morning as InPost, one of the sector's biggest players, shares its financial results. Will Baines looking at that and the rest of the morning's business news. Morning to you, Will.
Morning, Nick. Morning, Michelle. Yeah, not often we get to do financial results in the 6 o'clock slot here, but InPost listed in Amsterdam, so we do get a snapshot of them, and pretty extraordinary results in terms of that feel for the popularity of these. Revenue tripling, parcel volumes increasing 163% to more than 23 million parcels going through their locker system, and expanding the number of lockers they have in the UK to more than 7,000. Now, Michael Rouse is the chief executive of InPost International. Michael, morning.
Good morning, Will. Nice to speak to you.
Yeah, nice to speak to you as well. Does seem to speak to that people and retailers themselves really want this service.
Yeah, look, I think we've seen in the last 12 months, as you just flagged, our volumes have tripled in the UK. I think the encouraging part is every single new locker we put into the ground, we're seeing increasing performance of what we call that cohort. So we're seeing increasing consumer demand. Initially, as we developed the UK business, we very much focused on basically London, Manchester and Birmingham, really from high density and high population areas. But also over the last 12 months, we've started to expand those services as we made the investment into Menzies distribution to really complement with an end-to-end logistics service. And now as we expand the service across the UK on a 7-day service, we continue to see increasing usage. And most recently, we've expanded the service to not only just do returns and reselling from circular marketplaces, but also expanding now to offer complementary service to traditionally what has been a to-door market. We're still early in that journey, Will, so we've got a few customers in pilot mode, customers like H&M and Zara, as an example, and recently River Island last week. But the early results of that are also encouraging, just demonstrating the more convenience and the more choice you're giving the UK consumer, then clearly there's an alternative model to the traditional to-door in the market.
Quite clearly, you're reliant on some of those partners, right, and what they choose to do around some of their policies. And there's been a big shift, hasn't there, to charging and charging more for returns. That could potentially be pretty detrimental to your model, couldn't it?
And I think it's a fair comment, and I think it's something we're observing. Returns is a big part of our business. But, you know, I think the overall challenge with the e-commerce market in the UK, even with the charging, we still see returns being typically 1 in 4, in terms of the overall parcel market. And clearly we do see actually the choice and convenience of returns actually driving even more customer loyalty back to the brands that we work on. So there's sort of a contradiction in that comment, in that clearly the retailers want to charge to try and deter it, but there's also the data that we see, the more easy you make the returns, the more loyal the customer is for the retailer. But, you know, it's the way we look at the locker is the alternative, the way you would look at sort of return in store. So we're providing convenience, and not all retailers either have that physical presence to do that, unlike, you know, some of the other mainstream.
In terms of physical space, is there a danger that you sort of run out of finding spaces to put these 7,500, or are you sort of innovating in that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's a comment I get asked all the time. When does the headroom hit? You know, if you look at the data models, and there is a lot of data science that goes behind this. It's not just about going out and just finding a random space, because there's land registration as well as customer footfall and flows that you're looking for. You know, today we're over 7,500. You know, the target model, we call it a white space model in the UK, is in excess of 30,000, to give you an example. So, you know, we're still early in that journey. I do believe innovation is quite critical here. You know, typically we'd have in the past looked at sort of very simple sort of 2 to 4 meter configurations. Now we're splitting the configuration so you can put lockers around the corner from one another and still create connectivity. Battery operated is quite critical. Indoor development. We're working with a number of our landlord partners to really think about the right model for indoor. And, you know, we're testing that in the same way you'd have seen a Coke machine in a supermarket, over the last decade. You know, lockers are now starting to look at sort of an alternative as you know, as store owners look for footfall drivers. And they also look for, you know, because as one landlord put it to me recently, you know, parcel is the new oil. Right, because really e-commerce is still at its still at its early development, and there's a lot of growth still as the market continues to develop, and the UK is the largest market in Europe for it.
And we heard from Ofcom yesterday on the programme, speaking to Emma about changes that they may or may allow to the universal service for Royal Mail. I just wondered, what does that mean? Is that another opportunity for you?
Yeah, I mean, actually, coming back to my point of developing outside of the major conurbations, I think one of the really interesting developments as sort of we're still very early in our journey still in the UK market, despite our success, you know, we're low single digit market share, so lots of headroom, but is what I would call the underserved population. I've had a number of conversations in the last 12 months as our services have developed, and we've, you know, put lockers into locations in, you know, north of Scotland or in West Wales or, you know, the southwest of England. Not to say they should be underserved, but the reality is they don't get the same level of service as somebody might get in London or Manchester or Birmingham today. And those services, if they're impacted, then clearly means there's a sort of even less lack of a service. And that continuously we're looking for ways to develop that. So that's something that very much today with our investment into Menzies that covers all these areas today, 7 days a week, delivering newspapers, that we feel we can actually serve very effectively.
Michael Rouse, the Chief Executive of InPost International, thanks so much for your time. Will Walker-Arnett, the Director of Private Clients at Charles Stanley, is here with us to pick through what else is going on financial markets this morning. Will, morning.
Morning, Will.
More US economic data later, and I guess that is the key focus for markets.
Absolutely. Traders have certainly got their blinkers on this morning, Will, and are purely focused on the employment data, which is going to be printed in the US at lunchtime in the UK. I mean, we saw a significant sell-off in US equities on Tuesday, and this was after some disappointing manufacturing data. And so this was also sort of slightly confused and muddled by some data out yesterday. US services data was positive, but again, there was some nervousness about employment data. The market is expecting 160,000 jobs to be created in the month of August when the data is released, so we'll keep an eye on that. But there are key messages. We think the US economic data remains resilient, robust. There's strong economic growth, high levels of employment, and the fact the market's anticipating 7 to 8 rate cuts by mid-2025 in the US seems too much in our mind.
What's your sense of which is having the biggest impact on global markets at the moment? People watching the US economy or people wondering about whether the returns versus investment in technology stocks are actually in line with each other, or are they at 50-50?
Yeah, well, they probably are 50-50, because the last big bit of volatility we had was on Tuesday, and the reason for that was twofold. One, the mixed economic data out of the US, but also there was some poor data from the semiconductor industry, and we saw some big moves in the likes of NVIDIA. So it is a combination of the two, and actually you would say that the two key monthly data points is number one, you'd have over the last month has been the US employment data, but number two has actually been NVIDIA quarterly results. And that has a big impact now on market sentiment.
Here in the UK, Will, we've got another one of these reshuffles in the FTSE, so people moving up and down from the various indexes. How significant is that to be part of the FTSE 100, say the top index as well?
It is. It does attract a lot of passive investors, so ETFs are compelled to buy. An interesting actual sort of piece of financial innovation is actually there's an ETF coming out in the US this month, which actually is focusing on companies which have just been removed from an index. And this is a contrarian strategy whereby they think that companies which have dropped out could be unloved, and it's sort of playing on mean reversion. So it does go both ways, actually.
Hiscox, the insurer, one of those moving up, Burberry and EasyJet, the airline, moving down to the FTSE 250. Will, Never Knowingly Unsold coming back at John Lewis, make sense to you to bring back what was kind of their calling card, I guess?
They've been through a difficult period, John Lewis, and I mean, just to give a bit of context, they had three consecutive years of losses. I think they've just hit their first profit in a long while, and it's a new strategic direction because obviously Dame Sharon White is leaving after 5 years. She failed really in an initiative to develop a non-retail business. You'll remember she was focusing on things like build to rent and financial services, so it's a return to their core, so we'll wait to see how it plays out.
Well, then new executive director, who was their old executive director, Peter Ruiz, rejoining the business after a 10-year absence, has been speaking to Emma Simpson about that change.
We've spoken a lot to customers and partners and our brands, and everyone wants it back. Everyone sees it as fundamental to our DNA. And we had to pause it because the price mechanism wasn't working. It was causing confusion. We've now come back with something simple, agile and easy to use.
Peter Ruiz, the executive director at John Lewis, speaking to the BBC's Emma Simpson. Maureen Hinton, independent retail analyst, but previously also research director at Global Data PLC, who've worked with John Lewis, is with us. Maureen, morning.
Good morning.
A sensible move from your perspective?
Yes, I think it is, because it's a strong message to drive loyalty to the brand. And if they can back it up with good service, which they're investing more in, and convenience, then it's really going to help out. You know, as we were hearing from InPost earlier, that convenience on the online online travel that you get, the journey that you get with buying online, that will help as well. So I think it's a really strong message for the company to get consumers back to the store.
In an online retail landscape, though, and this is something that Emma went on to question Peter Ruiz about, is it realistic, this Never Knowingly Undersold message?
I think there might be some frustration with shoppers in the fact that it's only limited to 25 market leaders across all their different sectors. So it's not matching every single price that you can get out there. So there might be some frustration with that. The fact they're using AI to check prices will help with their admin costs. So I think it's more about the marketing message than the actual execution of it. So we'll see what customers really think of it. But I think it's still a strong loyalty message for them.
Still some journey to go, though, isn't there?
Yeah, there definitely is. Will was saying earlier, there is the improvement in profits, and they say that they're on a strong trajectory in terms of growth and profits, and they've got a better financial backing, so they've got the money to invest in this particular move and across their stores and online business. But as we've seen with Marks and Spencers, it can take some time to turn a business round. But I think there's a lot of goodwill for John Lewis still.
Maureen Hinton, independent retail analyst, thanks so much for your time.
Will, thank you very much indeed. It's 28 minutes past six. Gary's here with the sports. Morning, Gary.
Good morning to you. England plays Sri Lanka in the third and final test at the Oval this morning. Leicestershire's Josh Hull will make his debut, with England 2-0 up in the series. And Jonathan Agnew looks ahead.
It would be a big surprise if England slip up here. Apart from the injuries to Stokes and Crawley, this rebuilding summer has gone very well. The brave and potentially ticklish selections of Smith and Bashir have proved successful. And today, the most left-field pick of the summer, and surely for many years, will be put to the test. Hull has played only 10 first-class matches in his life and taken a grand total of 16 wickets at an average of 63. This summer, his tally is 2 at 182 runs each. This is a massive punt. But he brings left-arm pace from 6 feet 7, a very rare quality indeed, and having been around the squad for the last fortnight, England clearly like what they see. And besides, Brendan McCullum has the happy knack of getting the big calls right.
And England coach Brendan McCullum will be my guest at 7.25. It was announced earlier this week he'll also coach England's white ball teams. He was offered the job by Rob Key.
When Keyesy asked me if there was a world in which I'd do all the jobs across English men's cricket, it didn't take a whole lot of persuading, to be honest, because you know now I'm a couple of years into the post and running the Red Bull side alongside the skipper, and I've a lot more equipped, I guess, knowing that I've the ins and outs of English cricket and knowing the talent that sits within English cricket become incredibly exciting, and I'm really excited about taking on the new role. I know it's going to be different and I know it's going to mean more work, but at the same time it's a great opportunity.
Scotland's disappointing 2024 continued at Hampden Park in the Nations League. Trailing 2-0 to Poland at half-time, they came back to draw level with goals from Billy Gilmour and Scott McTominay. Then in the 97th minute, Poland scored a penalty to win 3-2. Northern Ireland defeated Luxembourg 2-0. Cristiano Ronaldo became the first player to score 900 top-level career goals, helping Portugal to a 2-1 win over Croatia. There are 57 medals to be won today at the Paralympics, and at 8.30, Sarah Storey will attempt to win a 19th career gold. At around that time, I'll be speaking to former Prime Minister Sir John Major on a range of cricket stories.
Thank you very much, Gary. Look forward to that. Meanwhile, tomorrow evening, there's a new series of something called Political Thinking coming up.
I was definitely too young when I was Leader of the Opposition, not to do many of the other jobs I did in government.
Admissions and insights from the people who shape how we think.
I would say my family, well, gave myself and my two siblings a critical eye.
And because it's not just politicians who mould our lives, we also hear from economists, comedians and best-selling authors.
It's the fastest way to change things. You do need politics, but if you want to change something overnight, culture is the quickest way to do it.
Conversations, not newsy interrogations. The new series of Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson, starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds tomorrow evening at 5.30. Better give that a try. First one is with the Chief Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, who we heard an extract of that interview on the programme yesterday. The time now is 29 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson. And Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is chairing a high-level meeting to discuss progress on efforts to break up the criminal gang smuggling people across the Channel. She'll hear from senior ministers, law enforcement bodies and intelligence agencies. 12 more people died on Tuesday attempting the crossing. Ms Cooper said their deaths illustrated the moral imperative in dismantling the smuggling networks. The European Union's climate monitor, Copernicus, says the last 3 months have seen the warmest June and August and the hottest day on record. A report from the agency said there had been a string of record high temperatures throughout the year. A former boss at a cladding company heavily criticised in the Grenfell Tower inquiry has told the BBC he played no part in the disaster. Claude Verler, who refused to give evidence in person, said he was not the one making decisions at the manufacturer Arconic. The inquiry accused him of deliberate dishonesty in order to sell his company's product. The Children's Crime Commissioner for England, Dame Rachel D'Souza, has called for mandatory background checks for private tutors. BBC News found that more than 90 of them have been convicted of sex crimes against children. There's currently no legal duty for them to have their criminal records checked, but ministers say they're looking at what further action could be taken to protect children. President Biden's son Hunter has changed his plea to guilty to tax fraud charges. Prosecutors say he failed to pay at least $1.4 million in taxes and had spent the money instead on drugs, sex workers and a lavish lifestyle. He said in a statement he was pleading guilty to spare his family the embarrassment of a trial. The body set up to protect the UK's honeybees says it's racing against time to destroy Asian hornet nests in Kent and Sussex before new queen hornets hatch later this month. The National Bee Unit says 10 nests have been found so far. And the indie band English Teacher have won the Mercury Prize for their debut album, This Could Be Texas. Judges praised its originality and character.
Thank you, Alan. It's 27 minutes to seven now. It is a moral imperative, says the Home Secretary, to stop the people smuggling gang. She was speaking ahead of a meeting of ministers, intelligence agencies, the police and border force officials. We heard from our correspondent earlier on the coast in Dover. Let's talk to our political correspondent, Damien Grammaticus, now. Those are the words, Damien. What are they actually proposing to do?
Morning, Nick. Well, I think that's the question and the pressure on the government, isn't it? Because we all remember how this was an issue in the last few months and the run-up to the election, and also the government's decision to scrap the Rwanda scheme. So the question then is, what can they deliver? What they're saying is that, first of all, you're going to have this meeting today bringing together these agencies, and that this shows part of the new focus, bringing together both cabinet ministers, border force, UK intelligence agencies. They will be discussing new approaches to this tackle smuggling gangs, collaboration with European agencies. And what they're pointing to are a few things. One is that they are already installing additional specialist investigators trying to work on this to disrupt the networks, and they reckon that is having some sort of impact already. The disruption they're pointing to is partly to the supply of boats and engines. So stationing some officers in Bulgaria has led to the seizure of 40 boats and engines that might have been transferred from there, that sort of thing. And then also on top of that, new posts in places like Austria, Southeast Asia, where the some of the sources of the sort of migrant smuggling routes are. So there's definitely a focus on sort of that ramping up the law enforcement.
Now, we know what they're not going to do. They're not going to do the Conservatives' Rwanda scheme. But just as Labour is saying, let's not do it, a German politician is saying, maybe we should do it.
Yes, that's right. I mean, this is Germany's migration commissioner, Joachim Stamp. Now, Germany, I think the particular issue there that he was highlighting was the use by Russia and Belarus of migration as a sort of weapon of hybrid warfare, trying to push people across, you know, sort of allowing migrants in and then trying to push them across the border into the European Union. And his suggestion was to use the idea of sending people to Rwanda and to look at that as a possibility. Now, a couple of things worth saying. I mean, he himself is the migration commissioner. He's from the sort of Free Democrat Party on the right. This would require some quite sort of significant legal changes in Germany, because migrants there can only be deported at the minute to a country that is not their homeland if they have a connection to it, such as relatives residing there. But it does show exactly the pressures on other European countries to face this issue too.
Damien Grammaticus, thank you. We'll be talking to the Immigration Minister at 10 past 8.
23 minutes to seven now. Companies involved in the refurbishment of the Grenfell Tower have been highly criticised in the public inquiry report. Now the BBC has managed to speak to one former senior figure at a cladding manufacturer, someone who refused to appear before the inquiry. Tom Simons, our correspondent, joins us, who's covered the inquiry closely. Who is this person, Tom, and what did he say?
Well, this is Claude Verler, who's the former head of the technical sales support team at the manufacturer Arconic. Now, Arconic made the sheets of cladding that was at the centre of the fire, really. It fuelled the fire, according to the Grenfell Tower inquiry report. Now, Mr. Verler caused outrage, really, among Grenfell victims by refusing to give evidence in person, coming from France, where he lives. And he said he was prevented from giving evidence by French law. We managed to contact him yesterday. A colleague contacted him in France and asked him about his position, really. And Mr. Verler said that he was not the one making the decisions about the sales of the cladding that was used at Grenfell. Now, just to give you a bit more background, Mr. Verler was heavily involved in the tests that were done on this cladding in the 2000s. And he realised, as is very clear from emails and evidence, that if the cladding was folded into box shapes, it became very much more likely to burn in a fire. And he actually sent an email in 2010 saying this should be kept very confidential. And so you can see why the public inquiry criticised him for what it said was effectively dishonesty. Now, we asked him about all of this, and he said that there were people in the company who were better placed than him to make decisions about, for example, telling British authorities about the test results that he had come up with. But he did say that the deaths in the tower were a tragedy more than a pity, and he said, "I feel the same way as any other human would, whether bearing no responsibility or at all or not." So really not saying very much to us, but certainly responding to our questions.
Tom, among the other firms who have been highly criticised by the report is the firm of architects that was behind the refurbishment, Studio E. What do you make of the Times reporting that it is being prevented from closing down?
That's certainly true. If you look at filings from the liquidator that has been covering the process of really closing this company down and has been for some years, it says that this is really on hold because of various litigation as a result of the Grenfell Tower fire in 2017. And the liquidator says that they are unable to advise when this is likely to be concluded, and suggests that that really partly depends on the outcome of the Grenfell Tower inquiry, which, of course, we now have. So I imagine that there will be work going on to resolve all of that. But I also know, having spoken to one of the lawyers in the civil cases that are still going on, most people who have claimed damages against all these companies have been given a settlement as a result of a decision to go into arbitration, to not to go to court, but to effectively pay something out of court. I know there might be some continuing litigation following that, and it's likely that Studio E is possibly still involved in that. But it is, the intention is, it seems, to close the company down. And it's worth saying that all of these companies remain very much in the focus of an ongoing police investigation. Now, the police have said that they can't consider whether to recommend prosecutions until they've really looked at the inquiry report, which is very long, 1,700 pages, and decided whether there is more to do. And that's going to be another 18 months, probably, before we hear about that.
Tom Symonds, thank you.
It's now 19 minutes to seven. Let's take a look at the morning's front pages. The Mail picks up the story we were just talking about. Rwanda is back, it says, but it's Germany planning to use it. It'd be a different sort of scheme, as we were hearing there, if it ever were to go ahead. But it is striking that a German politician is saying, why don't we use the facilities that Britain has abandoned? The Telegraph picks up another foreign country that is being suggested to deal with a domestic problem here. Prisoners could serve their time in Estonia, is the headline in the Telegraph. Now, it turns out that the previous Conservative government did look at using spare places in Estonian prisons because of prison overcrowding here. The current government has discussed it, although people are playing down the possibility in private.
The Eye has kept a very close eye on Brexit, post-Brexit food rules and food checks, and it is reporting this morning that checks on fruit and vegetables imported from the EU are again set to be delayed amid fears they could push up food prices. The government is now looking to delay the controls until the 1st of July, following warnings they could add to inflation, damage the food supply and put companies out of business. This is according to a leaked ministerial letter. They had been due to begin next month, were delayed until January, are now set to be pushed back for a further 6 months. They are a consequence of the UK leaving the EU single market and have already been previously delayed several times under the Conservatives amid fears of food price inflation and border chaos.
The shock on the front page of the Telegraph for many of you as you pick up your morning paper, if you do. I need a lie-in. Radio 4's Gary Richardson signs off. He hasn't signed off yet, but this is his penultimate shift after 50 years of being here at the BBC. Gary has his last presenting shift on Monday, although we'll hear him from time to time. And there's a nice piece written about him in the Telegraph showing a very youthful Gary interviewing Bill Clinton, President Bill Clinton, as he was at the time, I think, on Centre Court. And I looked through for things we didn't know. And this, I think, neither of us knew, did we? Which is Gary tries not to do today on a Saturday morning because he likes to do the Guildford Park Run. Every Saturday he says, I'm pretending to be Sebco, my personal best, 29:40. As I don't know, I don't do the park run. Is that good?
I think it's definitely good.
Of course!
Yes. Anything Gary does is good. I think we can say that now, given he's in his last couple of
mornings. There is one other huge piece of news that dominates the paper. Mm. Prince William's beard.
Yes. He's modelling himself on Nick Robinson, maybe. I mean, it's not much. You've got more of a beard than him. I say that's isn't that just a bit of designer stubble, maybe? Yeah. Not you, him, I mean.
Yeah, and I've got less hair, but there we are.
Our main news this morning, the Home Secretary is meeting senior ministers, intelligence agencies and law enforcement bodies to discuss progress in disrupting people smuggling gangs.
60 minutes to 7. MPs will vote on plans to change the rules on winter fuel payments for pensioners in England and Wales next Tuesday. The Leader of the Commons, Lucy Powell, told MPs yesterday in Parliament that the government wasn't afraid to have the debate. Here's our correspondent, Sean Curran.
Like characters in an Agatha Christie story who've gathered for the reading of a will, politicians are quick to complain about their inheritance and start pointing fingers. When they took office in 2010, David Cameron and George Osborne blamed spending cuts on the legacy left to them by the previous Labour government. Now Sir Keir Starmer and Rachel Reeves are making a similar argument. The Chancellor has complained that she inherited a £22 billion black hole in the public finances, forcing her to take tough decisions, like scrapping winter fuel payments for millions of pensioners. The Conservative Shadow Leader of the Commons, Chris Philp, thought Labour had got off to a poor start.
84% of pensioners in poverty will lose the winter fuel payment under these proposals. Is this their idea of a government of service leaving pensioners in poverty, shivering at winter time?
The Leader of the Commons, Lucy Powell, had just announced that MPs would get the chance to debate and vote on the plans to end the payments for older people in England and Wales who aren't on pension credit or other means-tested benefits. She said Labour had had to clean up the mess left by the Conservatives.
The legacy they have left us means we've had to make some really difficult decisions. Decisions we didn't want to make, like means testing the winter fuel payment. But we are doing all we can to support pensioners this winter.
The Liberal Democrats have been attempting to steer a middle course. Their spokesperson, Vera Hobhouse, argued that the government should insulate homes and increase pensions before changing the system for winter fuel payments.
We Liberal Democrats acknowledge and recognise that the previous Conservative government has left the country's finances in a mess, but pensioners should not be paying for the price of Conservatives' incompetence. Politics is about choices.
It's not just Treasury ministers who've chosen to blame the previous government. Here's Sarah Jones, an industry minister, talking about steel manufacturing in the UK.
The inheritance this government received from the party opposite was nothing short of a disgrace on steel. Over a decade of lurching from crisis to crisis with no clear plan to safeguard the future of a competitive domestic steel industry. But this government is determined to change that.
She'd been called to the Commons because a Conservative, Martin Vickers, had asked an urgent question about the industry. Part of the British Steel plant in Scunthorpe is in his constituency. Last year, the company announced plans for decarbonisation, which would involve closing two blast furnaces and replacing them with a greener electric arc furnace. Martin Vickers said it was a very worrying time.
There are rumours concerning the fact that employees will be given notice very soon. This is obviously creating great anxiety amongst those directly employed by British Steel and also those in the supply chain, which particularly in northern Lincolnshire extends to many thousands of people and many businesses.
Sarah Jones said he was right about the concern people felt and the importance of the jobs.
All I can say to him is we are talking regularly, as he would expect us to, with the trade unions, with British Steel, with the local community, and I cannot comment on those commercially confidential conversations, as I'm sure he can understand.
The Conservative Shadow Business Minister, Greg Smith, defended his party's record. He said the last government had worked to deliver a more sustainable, long-term future for the steel industry in the UK. And he argued Labour's plans for decarbonisation would lead to deindustrialisation.
The drive for green steel will mean fewer jobs, not more. And just like under the last Labour government, when output fell by 47%, the promises they made to steelworkers in Scunthorpe, Port Talbot, Teesside and across the country just weeks ago have been broken.
Reform UK's Richard Tice criticised both the Conservatives and Labour.
The hypocrisy of this debate is utterly extraordinary. Everybody agrees that steel is of strategic national importance. And yet it is both main parties, led by the Conservatives over there, whose obsession with net zero is leading to the removal of our blast furnaces.
And he said that was killing the industry and steel jobs. Sarah Jones said the government had to go with the market and told MPs that big companies wanted to buy green steel.
That was Sean Curran reporting on Yesterday in Parliament.
Time now is 11 minutes to 7. Things can get better if we invest to build a fairer, greener Britain. That is the upbeat slogan for the Green Party's conference taking place at the moment in Manchester. The party celebrating the election of four new MPs, up from one at the last general election. Ellie Chowns, one of those new MPs, Green MP for North Herefordshire, joins us on the line. Good morning to you.
Morning, Nick. Good
four,
to talk to you.
Four times as many MPs, but of course you are dwarfed by a vastly bigger number, 100 times more Labour MPs. So what difference can such a small number make?
I think we can make a really big difference, and we've shown that already. You know, we are one of the key voices actually holding the Labour government to account. We're trying to push them to be bolder and braver on things like recognising that it doesn't all need to be doom and gloom. We can invest to build a better country if we choose to make those decisions. I mean, of course, we would be a much bigger group if we had a more proportional electoral system. But even with four MPs, which, of course, is a quadrupling from what we had in the last parliament, we're making a real difference already in the House.
And you talk about wanting a fairer and a greener country. Now, we just heard in Parliament decarbonisation being discussed there. And yet, within weeks of coming into Parliament, your co-leader, Adrian Ramsay, what does he do? He opposes building electricity pylons through his own constituency in Suffolk, designed to produce precisely that greener future.
Actually, that's a complete misrepresentation. Adrian, as a constituency MP, is representing his constituents' views and arguing that there should be a full consultation on the proposals, which, by the way, every MP in that region from whatever party is taking the same position. But Adrian, as somebody who's worked in renewable energy his entire life, absolutely recognises the urgent need for us to transition away from fossil fuels towards those cheap, clean, green renewables that will give us a much brighter energy future.
When you say it's a misrepresentation, are you saying that a call for a full consultation isn't a way of delaying, isn't a way of channelling opposition? Because it sure sounds like that.
It's really crucial in whatever area of planning that local people have an opportunity to properly have their say and have their input. And my understanding of the proposals in East Anglia, I'm not an expert in that area. I represent the wonderful constituency of North Herefordshire. But my understanding in East Anglia is that the pylons proposal is not the bit that will delay what's happening. There's plenty of space for a full consultation on the pylon proposal.
The reason I raise it, and I guess it's relevant, the reason I think it's relevant when you're gathering for a conference is there's long been a division in the Green Party, divisions in all parties, but between radicals, as it were, and people are quite small-c conservative NIMBYs who don't like much change to their green pastures and to their bit of countryside. And it seems to many that that's illustrated perfectly by this policy.
I think, you know, in politics, I personally, and I think so many people really want to get away from the kind of binary sort of oppositional, you know, painting people into corners, say one's a radical, one's a NIMBY. These labels aren't helpful, actually. I think we really need to look for the common ground that we have together. I think there's massive common ground among so many people in this country, recognising the reality of the climate crisis, recognising the urgent need to transition to renewables, and also recognising that community voices have got to be heard in any big planning discussion. And of course, that local communities have got to benefit from community energy infrastructure. So whether we're talking about development of renewable energy, whether we're talking about building the new houses that this country certainly needs. And by the way, we should make sure that they are net zero houses with solar panels on top and fully insulated, you know, high quality houses so that they are fit for the future. Whatever these areas, I think we should be looking for the common ground. We should be making sure that everybody's voices are heard, because it's the sort of oppositional type of politics that really turns people off politics, actually.
Well, it's interesting you raise that.
Let's move away from that and find the common ground.
Interesting that you raise that, because I think it's the first time we've spoken to you on the programme. Forgive me if you've spoken on a day that I've not heard you. It's certainly the first time we've spoken since you were a Member of Parliament. Now, your experience, you've been a member of the European Parliament before that, but what are your impressions of Westminster? Now you're there. Is it a place that you feel comfortable in, or is it a place that you feel is old and antediluvian?
Oh, I mean, again, that's a kind of binary choice, isn't it? There are honestly so many things that I would really love to see change in the way that Westminster works, the way that the House of Commons works. I've spoken about this already in the House. I think it is crying out for modernisation, whether that's talking about the way that we sit, the way that we kind of put in a request to speak, the way that we vote. I mean, heavens, let's move to electronic voting. Yeah. And we could make a much bigger chamber where everybody's got a chance to properly sit and not be in that oppositional structure, but actually in a semicircle. All of these things, I think, I would love to see change.
We will discuss them in the future interviews. I'm afraid we're going to move on, Ellie Chadsen. But thank you so much for joining us, and no doubt talk to you on future occasions.
5 to 7 is the time. More than 3,000 schools in England will join a live-streamed assembly this morning focused on positive messages to pupils in the wake of this summer's riots. Now that it's the end of the first week back at school, the assembly will come from St Nicholas Church of England Primary Academy in Boston, Lincolnshire, where Fiona Booth is the head teacher and she will lead part of the assembly. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
Good to have you with us on what I'm sure is going to be a busy morning. How will you speak, Fiona, about these events and what happened? Because it was the school holidays at the time.
It was, yep. Yeah. So this morning is about facilitating a platform for children to ask questions, for misconceptions to be addressed, and for diversity to be celebrated, for difference to be celebrated. So it's really about opening up that stage that perhaps children haven't had for the last 6 weeks, where they can feel bold enough to question, and they can have the structure around them of their trusted adults that allow them to explore a really, really difficult situation.
How was Boston, how was your school community affected?
So our school community is made up of over 20 different cultures, 20 different languages, and we've only got 210 children. So highly, highly diverse. And we've got both ends of an extreme, really. We've got families who travelled to take part in violence, and we've had families who have been on the receiving end of prejudice and extremism in their own homes. So it's affected people hugely. And then there's the untold stories of what children, families have been exposed to online that streams into their homes and into their brains in an unfiltered way.
That is very sobering to think that all of those elements could, you know, reflected within community, and therefore makes one realise how important it is to have a space for children to talk about these things. And do you think that your pupils are even at their young age aware of what happened and how their families might have been involved in one way or another?
Absolutely. When the perspective that you're presented with over and over again through the media is that we live in a country that's fractured and that's hostile, they can't help but hear that. You know, every social media platform is feeding that. I think it was the education secretary that said that there's never been a more important time for education to facilitate you know, pupils encountering and understanding those from different backgrounds. Now is a really great reason to step forwards and not backwards, to stand up, not sit down, and say more, not less, because we need to challenge what people are being fed. You know, the brain believes whatever it's told, and that can be negative, but my goodness, it can be hugely positive. And we talk all the time in our school about having a light, and we need to let it shine. Now, that's not synonymous with religion or culture, language or social economics. That's about the connectedness of humans, humankind. And today is a really great opportunity for us as educators to continue being the guardians of childhood that have been given this grand task of being custodians of culture and helping children to disagree well, to ask questions, to listen, to turn take, all of the things that we're not necessarily presented with on a daily basis in the media.
Thanks so much for talking to us about the big back to school assembly. Fiona Booth.
2 minutes to 7. Time for the weather. Here's Stafford House.
Thanks very much, Nick and Michelle. Good morning to you. We've got a three-way split across the country today. I'll start with the south of the country, southern England into South Wales, the South Midlands. Here we're likely to see more cloud around, and also the risk of some heavy thundery showers or even longer spells of rain that could give rise to some localised flooding. So Met Office yellow warning for rain will affect southern areas through the course of today. That also goes for South East Wales. Much of the North Sea coast of both Scotland and also England will see low cloud and some mist and fog. So here rather grey and murky. But the rest of the country, western Scotland, northwest England, into Northern Ireland, North Wales, we'll see plenty of sunshine today. It's going to be warm with temperatures here, mid to high 20s. Across southern and eastern areas where we have more cloud, then generally the high teens and low 20s. That's your weather.
Stav, thank you very much. Coming up in the next hour of the programme, as the UN calls for news organisations to push harder to get access to Gaza, we will be speaking to CNN's Christiane Amanpour.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Nick Robinson. Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 6th of September. The headlines this morning: senior ministers are meeting police and intelligence officials to discuss action to stop people smuggling, 3 days after the deaths of 12 migrants in the Channel. Climate scientists say the past 3 months have seen the highest global temperatures ever recorded. A cladding company boss who's accused of dishonesty in the Grenfell Tower inquiry has denied contributing to the disaster. The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
The Home Secretary Yvette Cooper will chair a meeting of senior ministers, intelligence agencies and law enforcement bodies today to discuss what progress has been made in tackling criminal gangs who smuggle people across the Channel. 12 people died on Tuesday when their small boat came apart off the French coast. Ms. Cooper said this showed the moral imperative of dismantling the gangs. Our home editor Mark Easton reports.
More than 7,000 migrants have arrived in Britain after attempting to cross the Channel in small boats since the election. But the government believes progress is being made in disrupting the gangs which organise the crossings. The Home Office says the tragedy off the French coast on Tuesday is evidence that the business model of the smugglers is under pressure. More people are being crammed into less seaworthy vessels, with intelligence suggesting the gangs have increased their charges, including demanding payment for children. Ms. Cooper will today highlight significant seizures of boats and equipment in the last 2 months and 70 ongoing investigations, including an operation in Libya in which warehouses holding migrants were raided. However, after promising the rapid recruitment of a border security commander to oversee the response 2 months ago, Downing Street has said the appointment will be confirmed in the next few weeks.
The European Union's climate monitor, Copernicus, says that in the past 3 months, the world has experienced the highest temperatures ever recorded for the Northern Hemisphere summer. As well as the hottest June and August on record, the period also saw the hottest day, making it increasingly likely that 2024 would break the record for the hottest year. Carlo Buontempo, the director of Copernicus, said human-driven climate change was the main cause.
What we are seeing is not just a random fluctuation. It's not an oddity of climate that may be due to a strange combination of one of the many factors that affect the climate on this planet. But it's really, there is a disproportional effect that is induced by this long-term accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
A former boss at a cladding company who is heavily criticised in the Grenfell Tower inquiry
has denied playing a part in the disaster. Claude Verle, who works at Arconic, refused to give evidence in person to the inquiry, but his name appears in its report more than 100 times. The details from Tom Simons.
Claude Verle was head of the technical sales support team at the manufacturer Arconic. The inquiry report said he resorted to deliberate dishonesty to sell its Rainerbond cladding, including to firms in the UK. He had emailed colleagues in 2010 saying the product would not meet European fire standards for tall buildings, adding, "We have to keep as very confidential." Near his home in eastern France, he was asked by BBC News to give his reaction to the inquiry's report. He called the deaths of 72 Grenfell victims a tragedy and more than a pity, but he said he was not the one making the decisions about the sales of flammable Rainerbond PE cladding.
President Biden's son Hunter has pleaded guilty to tax fraud. He'd been about to stand trial in Los Angeles, but changed his plea at the last minute. Prosecutors say he failed to pay at least $1.4 million in taxes, instead spending the money on drugs, sex workers and a lavish lifestyle. The 54-year-old could face up to 17 years in prison when he's sentenced in December. In a statement, Hunter Biden said he wanted to spare his family needless embarrassment. Outside the court, his lawyer, Abby Lowell, said the offences occurred when he was addicted to drugs.
Hunter decided to enter his plea to protect those he loves from unnecessary hurt and cruel humiliation. This plea prevents that kind of show trial that would have not provided all the facts or served any real point in justice.
The authorities in the US state of Georgia have arrested the father of a 14-year-old boy who was charged with shooting four people dead at a school on Wednesday. Police say Colin Gray allowed his son Colt to have a gun. Here's our North America correspondent Peter Bowes.
Colin Gray, who's 54, will, according to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, face four counts of involuntary manslaughter, two of second-degree murder, and eight counts of cruelty to children. His son was arrested at the scene of the shooting and taken into custody. The police said Colt Gray was armed with a semi-automatic style weapon when he shot and killed four people and injured nine others. Both father and son were questioned last year in connection with an online threat to commit a school shooting, but the FBI said at the time there was no reason to arrest them.
President Zelensky will press Ukraine's allies for more military support at a meeting at Ramstein Air Base in Germany this morning. Britain has promised to provide hundreds more short-range air defence missiles. Here's our defence correspondent, Jonathan Beale.
This is the 24th meeting of the US-led Ramstein Group, which includes dozens of Ukraine's allies who've helped supply weapons and ammunition in response to Russia's full-scale invasion. It's normally a gathering of defence ministers and senior officials, but President Zelensky is expected to attend this one in person. He's still trying to persuade allies to give Ukraine permission to use Western-supplied long-range missiles to hit targets inside Russia. Washington has yet to be persuaded. Ukraine's president has also appealed for more air defence systems, with Russia stepping up its own strikes in recent days. Britain says it will send an additional 650 shorter-range missiles as part of a new military aid package worth £160 million.
The explorer Dwayne Fields, the first black Briton to walk to the North Pole, has been named as the UK's new chief scout. He'll replace Bear Grylls, who's standing down after 15 years. Dwayne Fields was born in Jamaica and grew up in inner city London. He said he wanted to appeal to communities which may have been put off by what he called older ideas around scouting. Britain's National Bee Unit says it's in a race against time to destroy invasive Asian hornet nests before new queen hornets hatch by late September. So far this year, 10 nests have been found in southeast England, as Fiona Irving reports.
One nest of Asian hornets can kill 11 kilograms of insects in a single season. As an apex predator, they pose a significant threat to honeybees and other pollinators. All of the nests discovered so far this year have been found in Kent and Sussex, but the hornets have the potential to spread further across the UK. By the end of the month, around 100 newly hatched queen hornets can disperse from a single nest. If they survive the winter, they'll set up new colonies next spring. So there's an urgency to the UK bee unit's work as they tag and track live hornets. Just a single hornet can reveal the location of thousands of others in its nest.
This year's Mercury Music Prize has been won by the indie rock band English Teacher for their debut album This Could Be Texas. They beat the favourite Charlie XCX, whose record Brat inspired a cultural phenomenon over the summer. Colin Patterson was at the ceremony at Abbey Road Studios in London.
The winner of the 2024 Mercury Prize is English Teacher for their album.
The judges said the debut album by the Leeds indie four-piece English Teacher revealed new depths in every listen, which was the mark of a future classic. The band were the first winners in a decade not to come from London, and their singer Lily Fontaine was thrilled.
You don't start a band thinking that this is going to happen, and so it's a dream realised. I think that's why it means a lot, and also because it's for solid music. It's not just for, you know, being a good band or a good live band. It's for the music, and that's what we do this for.
Mostly it feels like a waste.
Afterwards, they joked that they would be spending the £25,000 prize on four tickets to see Oasis.
That was Colin Patterson at Abbey Road Studios.
Alan, thank you very much. It is 9 minutes past seven. Can the Labour government smash the gangs who buy the boats and set people off on them across the channel, overloaded, dangerous and sometimes deadly, as we saw again 3 days ago when 12 people died when their boat capsized? The Home Secretary chairs a meeting on breaking the gangs today. We'll speak to one of her ministers in an hour's time. But this week's loss of life was the worst since November 2021, when 27 people drowned on the way from France to England. This time the boat sank in 5 minutes, one survivor from Eritrea said. He tried to grab his 18-year-old sister's hand, but a wave pushed them apart and she was among the dead. Christa Rottensteiner is from the International Organisation for Migration. It is the UN's migration agency and she is its chief of mission in the UK. And we're also joined by Tony Smith, former head of the UK Border Force, who advised the last government for a time on this issue. Good morning, both of you.
Good morning.
Tony, what would you say is the key to achieving this objective of smashing the gangs?
Well, I think we're seeing today the first green shoots of the new border security command that's been promised. A commander has not yet been appointed, but I suspect today's meeting will be with those agencies already involved in this business. Of course, we have the Special Boats Operational Command in Border Force. We have the Crime and Financial Investigation Teams in Enforcement. We have the National Crime Agency. There are already a number of players who are working together to try to smash the gangs. And I suppose today will be an attempt to work out, well, what will this new command do? How will it work within the existing infrastructure? What additional powers will be confirmed to whom? And, you know, how will it be resourced? So I think it's probably a little bit of an assembling of a jigsaw puzzle today domestically. But I think the bigger challenge is, you know, how is this going to work in France and in Europe where the gangs are operating?
And is that absolutely crucial to it succeeding or failing? Because otherwise you smash one gang and there's another one, or you didn't smash the French or Dutch or German arm of that particular gang.
Yeah, so you may recall we had a channel threat commander under the previous government whose role was certainly upstream disruption as well. And we know that didn't stop the boats in the end. And I think that is the point, is that this is a very lucrative business for the smugglers. And, you know, putting a smuggling gang out of business, there's usually another one waiting in the wings because the money is there. It's a bit like whack-a-mole, really. So you do need a very concerted international attempt, both in Europe and beyond. Let's not say we're not doing anything. We do have officers posted in different countries upstream, but I think this is really such a huge international problem, human smuggling, that, you know, we will need to be working very, very closely, hand in glove almost, with Europol and the European Border Agency and so on, if we're going to have any real traction in cutting off the supply chains.
Christa Rottensteiner, do you welcome these efforts to smash the gangs?
I think having seen this last terrible tragedy in the Channel, it's really clear that something needs to be done to prevent further tragedies. this weren't the only deaths. I mean, it's really been a tragic week for migrants. We've had three separate shipwrecks in the Med, and IOM has been recording deaths for the last 10 years, and we see that the numbers are steadily going up. So absolutely, something needs to be done to tackle irregular migration and to tackle dangerous journeys. But I think it's really important to take a broader perspective and to first of all look at why people are moving and are taking these dangerous journeys. Because no one would put their children on such flimsy dinghies that we see in the Channel unless they felt they had absolutely no alternative. So we need to create these alternatives. IOM works in over 170 countries, and we see that people leave out of desperation, they flee conflict. So we need to see better global efforts to address the reasons why people move, try to prevent conflict, try to help communities cope better with climate change. But we also need to see more safe and legal ways for people to travel, because that will take the demand away from the smugglers.
Well, so what will we it? Really need... Will it? It's an important point, but will it do anything more than perhaps give a few people who will otherwise come this way a safe and legal route?
It's a really difficult challenge. There is not one magic solution to this problem, but we need to really look at all the elements of it and have a comprehensive approach. So we need to tackle the reasons first and foremost, because this is saving lives, but it's also the right thing to do to solve conflict and to bring development to countries which are struggling. And there aren't enough safe and legal ways for people to travel, which is fueling the demand. And if we had more of those routes, that would again take some of the business away from the smugglers. But I think good international cooperation is also at the heart of it. So tackling smuggling along the whole migration routes. And we should also remember that a lot of people, well, most people actually staying in neighboring countries, they aren't traveling further. They stay really close to home. So we also need to support those neighboring countries better that are often poor countries. But two-thirds of people are hosted in them rather than traveling further.
Tony Smith, we now know that the German government is interested in using the same Rwanda facilities which the UK under the last government had committed to, and which Labour then scrapped when it scrapped the Rwanda plan. Would you like to see Labour reconsidering its decision to scrap that, because it could act as a deterrent?
Well, yes, I would, because I think the key to this is deterrence. Whilst I can understand the argument that, you know, there are very many people around the world that want to resettle, the supply far exceeds the demand. And so therefore we need an alternative. And the key to deterrence is removals. We need to be able to make it clear to migrants in France, who are after all already in a safe country, that actually it won't work getting in a small boat. You won't get to stay in the UK, and that you're likely to be relocated elsewhere. In Rwanda was, I think, a very bold attempt by the last government to say that those nationals who are already in safe countries are still saying they fear persecution back home won't be sent back home. Actually, there is an alternative where you can live your life safely, and that is Rwanda, and that would send the deterrent message across the Channel that this is simply not worth you paying money, putting your lives at risk, your family's lives at risk, to get to the UK, because it doesn't follow that once you get into British territorial waters, you will be allowed to stay here.
Tony Smith and Krista Rottensteiner, thank you.
It is 16 minutes past seven. What does Ukraine need to hold off Russia's advances, let alone to have any chance of winning its war? That's what the country's allies, including Britain's new Defence Secretary John Healey, will be discussing at a meeting in Germany today. The UK is promising to send Ukraine another 650 short-range missiles. We're joined by Professor Michael Clark, academic and director of the Royal United Services Institute until 2015. Good morning to you, Professor Clark. Hundreds of missiles. I suspect they want thousands, don't they?
Yes, they do. You know, they need more of everything at the moment. And hundreds of missiles certainly helps. But the speed with which they're being used up means that they'll be exhausted within, you know, a couple of months, one would imagine, given the intensity of Russian advances and the bombardment which the Russians are meting out to Ukraine at the moment.
And are they not getting the thousands because of a lack of will in Western capitals, or frankly, just a lack of stocks? We're running out of them.
It's both, and things have been arriving too slowly. And though they've got the system, so they've got, you know, some Patriot batteries. Patriots are the best in the world for bringing down pretty well everything. But Patriot batteries cost $1 billion each, And the battery itself costs about 400 million. And the ammunition for the battery, the missiles, costs about 600 million. And so it's not the batteries that they need. It's more and more ammunition. And in this case, I mean, we should be clear. this is what we know as the martlet system, this medium, flexible, lightweight, multi-role missile. We call it the martlet. And this is very much a tactical missile. So it's designed to be fired either from the ground or from a helicopter. It's got quite a small warhead, but it's very useful. We haven't fully integrated it into our own forces yet. The Army have got some, which they use with Starstreak. And the Navy are still waiting to go fully operational with it on their Navy helicopters. So it'll make a difference to the tactical battle, but it won't really help the Ukrainians defend themselves against incoming ballistic missiles targeting their main cities.
Now, it's a few weeks since we saw that bold incursion of Ukrainian forces into Russia in Kursk. Does that now look like a clever military strategy to divert Putin's resources, or an eye-catching adventure that might go wrong?
Well, both. it's certainly an eye-catching adventure. And we said at the very beginning this was pretty audacious and risky, and we're now into the fifth week of it. And the Ukrainians are getting the political benefit of all of this, and it has created a great deal of disquiet within Russian circles, even though Putin keeps quite quiet about it. But the thing that the Ukrainians must have wanted was to relieve pressure in the south, in Pokrovsk, in Chazivyar. These are the two particular places down in the southern part of the Donbass, 300 miles away from Kursk. This is where the Ukrainians will have wanted to relieve the pressure, and that hasn't happened yet. So the Russians are bringing forces in from all over the place, from Kaliningrad, from Burkina Faso in Africa. They're bringing one of their brigades back from there, one of their Wagner-style brigades. They're bringing forces from Vovchansk further east and so on. But they're not taking forces away from Pokrovsk and Chazivyar, which they seem determined to take before the winter.
Quick last one. How worried are you by Russia's new tactics? Targeting the Kyiv Dam sounds like potentially quite a major escalation.
Yes. I mean, they play about with environmental disasters. I mean, we think of the Novokachkochi Dam that was the Russians blew over a year ago now and caused a great deal of problems in the Dnieper Valley, the southern Dnieper Valley down towards the Delta. So, yes, they threaten this because at the moment the Russians will do anything to diminish Ukraine's ability to carry on. And they are determined to give Ukraine a really miserable winter as a way of building pressure on the Ukrainian government.
Professor Michael Clark, thanks for joining us again.
It is 20 past seven. A new report has been quantifying the amount of additional investment the UK needs to secure the objective of good long-term economic growth. Will's been looking at it.
Michelle, this is the Michelle. This is the Capital Markets of Tomorrow report published today, and reckons the UK requires more than £1 trillion of additional investment over the next decade to try and improve those growth rates. Sir Nigel Wilson, former chief executive of Legal & General, Britain's biggest investment group, now the chair of the Capital Markets of Tomorrow group, has led this report and is with us. Sir Nigel, morning.
Good morning.
Significant action needed, you say, to meet that target. Clearly, what type of action?
Well, I think we have to take a positive and optimistic view of the UK economy, recognising that we've done a really poor job for the last 20 years with no growth in real wages, productivity and real per capita income. And that's all caused by lack of investment. We're always bottom of the G7 in terms of the percentage of investment that we have in our economy. And the good news is we've got all the money. We've got £6 trillion of long-term capital in the UK to invest. We've chosen over the last 20 years not to deploy that capital for the common good and actually raising the living standards of people in Britain. We've talked about building 300,000 houses since I was a boy, and that was the last time we achieved it in 1969-70. We've got to make that happen. You know, water industries, you know, is systemic underinvestment for 20 years, and we're now going to try and fix it, but it's energy needs another £30 to £50 billion per annum. Transport, you know, we've got potholes everywhere and we're spending gazillions on HS2. So there's huge, we've got all the money, we've got all the opportunities. We've really got to stop being the selfish generation. My generation's been the selfish generation. We got free university, cheap housing, gold-plated DB, but we really didn't develop the economy to drive growth and create a better future for everyone.
Well, talk practicalities then. What needs to happen?
Well, practicalities, you know, the Labour Party recognise you've got to change the planning system, but it's not just the words, it's the outcomes that you've got to deliver. And too often we make fine words, the ministers change, and nothing really happens around that. We have to change some of the tax rules in Britain. And most of all...
And how worried then that you're hearing all the drumbeat in the run-up to the budget is that that isn't going to happen. In fact, taxes might go up on things like capital gains and other areas of investment, stamp duty and investment.
Yeah, and I think that's some of that's likely to happen, but it won't profoundly affect the opportunities that we have, and we shouldn't look for excuses for not doing things, and that would be an excuse for not doing things. When these things are relatively straightforward to do, we have the money to do them, we've just chosen not to do them for a long period of time because you know, we've been selfish about it.
And a quick thought on the British ISA. Sounds like it might be going. That was something you recommended.
Yeah, that's a rounding error in the overall equation. We've got we've got the best PE industry in the world. We've got almost the second best venture capital system in the world. Our banks are loaded with capital right now. Our pension funds are investing in all the wrong sorts of assets. And these are... We've got to take opportunities as they come along and really invest this money wisely. We've chosen not to do that for the last 20 years. We've got to step up and really deliver for the public. And at the moment, there's not enough a debate about how we're going to grow the economy. And there's too much of the blame game going on right now.
Sir Nigel Wilson, Chair of the Capital Markets of Tomorrow Committee. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. 23 minutes past seven. An explorer became the first Black Briton to reach the North Pole. It's been announced as the UK's new chief scout. Dwayne Field grew up on an inner city estate in London and turned away, in his words, from a life of weed, cocaine and guns. He takes over the role of representing the country's 500,000 or so Cubs and Scouts from Bear Grylls, who's been doing the job. And for over a century before that, the position of Chief Scout was largely the preserve of privately educated, retired officers from the armed forces. So when I spoke to Dwayne a little bit earlier, I congratulated him and asked him about his new job.
The Chief Scout title is grand. It's much more than I ever believed I would ever achieve. But also it comes with a lot of responsibility. That's what it means to me. I mean, right now in the UK, we've got 500,000 plus scouts that meet every single week. We've got 145,000 plus great volunteers that support these young people that we that meet in our huts and groups every single week. And, you know, they look to me for some leadership. They look to me as a role model, and it means that I have to fill that space with the support of the leadership team. And I think it gives me the platform to explain to them that I walked through the doors of a scout hut in North London when I was 7 years old, scared, new to the country, anxious, really shy. And it gave me a place to belong. Scouting gave me the someone to believe in me and allowed me to believe in myself.
The story of what scouting did for you is quite extraordinary, because when you say you were terrified and scared, you were surrounded by the most extraordinary violence growing up in East London.
So initially I actually grew up in North London. And for me, the challenge there was I was brand new to the country. I came from rural Jamaica. I didn't quite know how things here in the UK worked. And later I did move to East London, where street violence, you probably know from some of the reporting you've done in the past, there was a lot of street violence. There were robberies on the streets, there were knife crime, it was on the up and up. There were lots of issues, social issues, in terms of youth violence as well. And I think scouting instilled in me something, a level of self-belief that I carried through all of that. And it supported me in making the right choices at the right times. And I think it played a huge part in me being where I am today.
Your body is testament to that violence and what you had to survive before turning your life around.
Yes, yes. I'm assuming we're talking about the incident where, unfortunately, I was stabbed. I was a victim of street violence. I've never carried a knife in malice. I've never carried any instruments in malice. And I was, you know, I suffered a stabbing incident.
And also an attempted shooting.
Just for being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Yes, I did. I did. Again, this is the world that I grew up in. And it would have been so easy for me to slip and fall on the wrong side of the tracks. But in terms of my self-confidence, my self-belief, all those really important, I mean, sometimes we look at it and call them soft skills, empathy and patience and understanding and, you know, communication skills, all these things played a part in me making the right decisions at the right time. And arguably, I learned those and developed those in scouting.
And one of those decisions was that you wanted to be an explorer, as well as what you are now, TV presenter, reaching the North Pole.
Yeah, so way back in 2010, I decided the best way that I could make a difference was by being an example to people. And I decided to pick myself up from East London and walk to the magnetic North Pole, starting in Northern Canada. And that's exactly what I did. I thought, look, if I want to make a difference, I have to start by trying to be a role model and trying to be the change that I want to see.
What do you say to people listening who fear that scouting still has an old-fashioned image, that it's still the idea of the woggle and the uniform and Baden Powell, and that that doesn't appeal to modern young people who have the alternatives of, you know, the computer game and YouTube?
I'd say, listen, scouting is a great place to bring people together, make friends. I'm testament to that. It's a great place to develop all the skills that we still need, whether it's 1920 or 2020. We still need the skills of communication. We still need leadership. We still need to build our self-confidence and our self-belief. Scouting provides all of that. Now, there is an element of woggles and campfires and neckers to it. And I think that's the fun side. But the truth is, scouting provides a place for so many young people. 500,000 plus young people every single week meet up. 145,000 plus volunteers meet up. And they make a difference in their communities. They make a difference to young people's lives. And we're developing young people and growing the kind of world that we want to see. There's nothing like walking through an airport and seeing a necker on somebody else. And instantly you feel like you're part of something. And for me, that doesn't get old.
Dwayne Fields, UK Chief Scout, thank you so much for joining us.
It sounds great.
He does sound like a really inspiring choice, actually, as Chief Scout. The inspiring choice to present the sport all those years ago, Gary Richardson.
Were you a scout?
I was a cub.
Were you?
Yes.
What rank did you rise to? Because I was as a sixer.
Were you?
Yeah.
I can't remember. I remember the sausages cooking, but I can't really remember what.
I think if I was in it now, they would sort of refer to me as being like Captain Mannering, wouldn't they?
Well, six is the leader of the pack, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm some brownie. Yeah. I seem to remember struggling with some of the badges.
What are the levels do they have?
I can't remember, Gary.
Oh, right.
So long ago.
Somebody will send up a postcard and tell us, or an email. Later today at the Oval, England play Sri Lanka in the final test, and it's been announced that the England coach, Brendan McCullum, will also lead England's white ball teams. Well, I asked him about that when I popped to the Oval yesterday. It was a job offered to McCullum by the ECB managing director, Rob Key.
When Keyesy asked me if there was a world in which I'd do all the jobs across English men's cricket, it didn't take a whole lot of persuading, to be honest, because, you know, now I'm a couple of years into the post and running the Red Bull side alongside the skipper, and I've a lot more equipped, I guess, knowing that I've the ins and outs of English cricket and knowing the talent that sits within English cricket become incredibly exciting, and I'm really excited about taking on the new role. I know it's going to be different and I know it's going to mean more work, but at the same time it's a great opportunity.
But why do you want the extra workload and the extra pressures, perhaps?
Well, I think the bet's worth it, to be honest. You know, there's some pretty cool things coming up in the next 3.5 years. You know, a couple of Ashes series, some World Cups, and some talent which is ready to explode on the international scene, and some untapped talent out there as well. And it's worth the extra work and the extra risk, and you don't get anywhere in life if you're not prepared to have a bit of a punt, right? And so I'm excited by where it sits.
Joe Root has had a record-breaking summer. As a coach, do you still offer him any advice at all? Because, I mean, he's just brilliant. Can you ever say anything to him about the way he's performing?
Well, you can say, well, batted.
Yeah, but you know the point I'm making.
Yeah, I know the point. Like, I'm not a real technical coach at all. I don't coach technique. I think, for me, trying to create an environment and trying to deal with people constantly, and even the greatest sometimes have times where they need an arm around them, or I guess someone to talk to. So I try and create an environment where the likes of Joe, he knows where he wants to get to, where he wants to go, and he knows how to get there. So you just try and provide that environment, and you're there when needed.
And you said there, put your arm around. Have you done that with Ollie Pope? Because he's the standing captain and he's been having a tough time with the bat. So has your arm gone round it?
Not really. Like, to be honest, I put my arm around them all the time, all those boys. I think, you know,
but perhaps I'll leap over a bit more.
You treat them all like your own kids, you know, because you got genuine affection for them and you want to see their talent come out. Ollie's doing a really good job. It was only, was it 3 test matches or so ago, he was in red hot form against West Indies, and he's had a couple of low scores, which if you're about at number 3 in England, you're a fair chance of doing. So I think he's doing a really good job as captain. He's got two test wins under his belt in a standing capacity, and I couldn't be happier with what he's doing.
And that's the thing, statistics. England have had a very good summer.
We have had a good summer, and we've been tested right throughout the summer, but I think we've been able to identify those moments and be able to make good decisions in those moments, and at times shift pressure onto the opposition in those key moments. And ultimately, we've been able to find a way across the line, which is really pleasing. We've also introduced a lot of talent this summer, which has been exciting and just a slight refreshing of where we're at. And I think that's great for the side moving forward to the challenges that we have in front of us.
Brendan McCullum, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Test match special starts at 10:25. Just to tell you, Scotland's disappointing 2024 continued at Hampden Park. They lost to Poland 3-2. They were trailing 2-0 at half-time before goals from Gilmore and McTominay pulled them level. Poland won the match with a penalty in the 97th minute. And also in the Nations League, Northern Ireland defeated Luxembourg 2-0. Coming up at 8:30, cricket chat with Sir John Major on a range of subjects.
Look forward to that.
Thanks very much, Gary. Let's take a moment here about tonight's 6:30 comedy.
Hello, I'm Andy Zaltzman. With the new series of the News Quiz imminent, I'm bouncing on a trampoline. It's a scientifically proven fact that you can't be cross on a trampoline. So I bang on mine to calm down whenever I'm annoyed by the news. Hopefully, over the next couple of months, though, my News Quiz panellists can help me cut down to just 10 hours bouncing per day from my current 23. I need another copy. Please bounce responsibly. Tune in to the new series of the News Quiz to find out. Friday night, 6:30 comedy on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Quick look at the weather today. Most areas will be dry with sunshine. Then it says heavy and thundery rain in the south, so they won't entirely be dry. Maybe later it's going to be raining.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is meeting senior ministers, intelligence agencies and law enforcement bodies today to discuss progress on breaking up the gangs, bringing people across the channel. Her department believes that the deaths of 12 people when their boat fell apart on Tuesday is evidence that the business model of the smugglers is under pressure, forcing them to cram more people into smaller vessels. Ms. Cooper said the tragedy illustrated a moral imperative to dismantle the gangs. The European Union's climate monitor, Copernicus, says the last 3 months have seen the warmest June and August and the hottest day on record during the Northern Hemisphere summer. The agency said a string of record temperatures made it increasingly likely that this year would be the hottest on record. A former boss at Arconic, a cladding company heavily criticised in the Grenfell Tower inquiry, has denied playing a part in the disaster. The inquiry found that Claude Verla, who refused to give evidence in person, had been deliberately dishonest in order to sell his company's product, but he told the BBC he wasn't the one making decisions at the company. Police in the US state of Georgia say they've arrested the father of a 14-year-old boy who's been charged with shooting four people dead at a high school on Wednesday. Colin Gray faces 12 charges, including involuntary manslaughter. Police say he knowingly allowed his son to possess a weapon. The Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to make another appeal for more Western military support when defence ministers from his country's allies gather at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany this morning. Britain says it will send an additional 650 shorter-range missiles as part of a new military aid package worth £160 million. And the explorer Dwayne Fields has been named the UK's new chief scout, replacing Bear Grylls after 15 years. Mr. Fields, the first black Briton to walk to the North Pole, was born in Jamaica and grew up in London. He says scouting has helped make him the person that he is.
24 minutes to 8. Thank you, Alan. Shouting, screaming, fights, sometimes despair. That is life in Pentonville Prison in London, one of the most overcrowded prisons in the country.
Please, fans, get your meds!
It's a code red.
HMP Pentonville.
Sounds there from a report you may have seen on last night's 10 o'clock news. The BBC senior UK correspondent Seema Katecha was granted access to Pendlebury Prison ahead of next week's early release of 3,000 prisoners, more to be released the following month. The government says it's all necessary because of severe overcrowding in jails, and plans were being drawn up by the Conservatives to do the same when they were in office. There are fewer than 500 places left in men's prisons in England and Wales now. Seema joins us on the line to tell us more of what she saw. Lively would be the rather coded word I would use to describe what you saw there, Seema.
Well, the word I've been using, Nick, is chaotic. It was just really fast-paced. I mean, I've been inside several prisons over the last decade or so, and some for the very programme that you're broadcasting on this morning, and I've never seen anything like this. I mean, over 2 days, we saw staff on the verge of breaking point, pushed to their limits as inmates got into fights, they self-harmed, they jumped onto the wing netting. And yes, as you say, it's one of the most overcrowded prisons in the country. Just to give you some idea, it was originally built for 500 inmates and now has more than 1,200. And during the 2 days that we were there, it only had 9 spare beds. And that means people are locked up for longer, staff are not able to do everything, and alarms are literally going off some days every 20 minutes. The staff said it had got a lot worse in recent months, with one of the officers saying that she had broken both her wrists trying to separate two gang members during a fight.
The gang affiliation, gang issues are the biggest reasons why we have so many probably people in jail. So it ends up us trying to stop them. We're just trying to stop the fight. That's how I broke both my wrists. Just trying to stop it. That wasn't even... Yeah, it just gets really messy sometimes, and they're quite small space.
Stressful?
Stressful. Yeah, stressful.
Now, the government was keen to show us the chaos because they're controversially releasing thousands of inmates early next week to make space. As you said, it hopes creating more space will alleviate some of that pressure, make the job more doable for the staff and those running the prisons, although some are very worried it will make our streets more dangerous. Pentonville's governor is Simon Drysdale. He says his staff are struggling to cope.
People are tired. You know, it's, you know, the system is running at 99.9% constantly, and when you run at that kind of high level of output for sustained period of time like we have done, you know, people get tired, you know, systems get frayed, and you know, and that does cause problems. I think come the 10th of September we'll see pressure in the system released. I think that will allow us some breathing time.
The governor of Pentonville Prison, Simon Drysdale, talking there to our correspondent, Seema Katecha. Incidentally, that whole report you can see on BBC News Online, well worth watching. Nick Hardwick was listening to that. He's former chief inspector of prisons, former chair of the parole board. Morning to you, Nick.
Good morning.
Do you recognise that picture of overcrowded prisons, of trouble, of violence, of noise?
Absolutely. I think Pentonville is not unique. There are many local prisons like that. I mean, like Seema Katecha, I've been in a lot of prisons. What I've noticed in some I visited recently is for the first time I've felt concerned about my own personal security. They're dangerous and frightening places, and staff are struggling to keep control.
Do you think, as the governor clearly does there, that come the 10th of September, as he put it, in other words, when the first 3,000 prisoners are released early, that will make something of a difference?
Yes, that will remove the immediate pressure. I don't think the government had any alternative in the short term but to do these releases. But it's a bit like squeezing a balloon. You release the pressure in one place, but the bulge goes somewhere else. And the real problem now is, first of all, some of those released will reoffend for certain. And some of those released, a lot of those released, I fear will end up homeless because there simply isn't the accommodation for them. So in the short term, I don't think the government had any alternative, but I think they do have some important choices in the longer term to stop this problem reoccurring.
You say people will reoffend. The first tranche of people released are people on less than 5-year sentences. The second are on longer than that. Do you fear that people may look and say, this was a very serious offender who's been let out and has committed another very serious offence?
I mean, all the offences we're talking about have caused real harm and distress to their victims. But I think it is worth being clear that about 50% of all of those who are currently released, who've done a sentence of less than a year, will reoffend within 1 year. And about a third of all prisoners reoffend within 1 year. So a lot of these people might reoffend when they're released early, but they probably would have reoffended a few months later if they'd been released on the original schedule.
Which takes...
But maybe no comfort to those victims, but I think it does tell you something about the overall safety and the state of prisons.
Which takes us back to your suggestion that a longer-term solution is needed beyond early release, taking the pressure off the system. Is your long-term solution simply locking up fewer people, as they do in many other countries?
I think the government has a choice. It can either try and build its way out of the problem, and it's currently planning to spend £4 billion building new prisons, or it can invest in trying to make the prisons we've got at the moment work better for the people they hold, reduce reoffending, and make sure that when people leave, they've got the sort of support that's going to keep them on the straight and narrow. So I think building more prisons might be the more popular options. Investing in reducing reoffending might be the one that works.
You will know that throughout your career, ministers of all parties have reached the conclusion that fewer people need to be locked up. But they don't do it. They don't think it's sellable. They don't think it's politically palatable.
Well, I think there is an opportunity with the new government. I think the other point is that we know that overall the public finances are under a lot of pressure and the government's going to have to make some really hard decisions about all sorts of public services. And I think in that context, the choice of whether we want to spend £4 billion building new prisons, billions every year running them, or whether we want to invest it in other things that make our society better, I think that might be a clearer choice for the public as a whole, not just for ministers.
Nick Hardwick, former Chief Inspector of Prisons, thank you for joining us.
It is coming up to 7:45. Let's bring you more now of our River series, which has all year followed the Bristol Avon, the state of its water and the communities who live along it and who need and enjoy it for different reasons. Some are also helping document it using the Big River Watch app. And that includes James Lavelle, who Emily Knight, our reporter, went to see on his boat.
Take your time to observe the river. This survey should take you 15 minutes. All right. Here we go. First name, James. Last name, Lavelle. Hello, my name's James Lavelle. I'm a filmmaker and I live on my canal boat here on the River Avon between Bristol and Bath.
Okay, next question. Has it rained in the last 24 hours?
It absolutely has. A fine summer's day on the River Avon. It's absolutely raining cats and dogs. Currently raining. There was a currently raining option. Go back. Currently raining. Yes.
Right, next question. Based on what you can see, what is your first impression of this river? We've got healthy, unhealthy or other.
This is the thing. I think you have to kind of know what to look for. I think to the untrained eye, the river would look fine. And a lot of what's wrong with the river isn't actually obvious anyway. But I am seeing quite a lot of runoff. The coloration of the river is a lot milkier and cloudier than it ordinarily is. Okay. So I'm going to say unhealthy.
The Big River Watch is not your first foray into citizen science, is it?
No, I and a bunch of other boaters and locals, we created a group called the Avon Otters, which is a citizen science group dedicated to monitoring levels of phosphates and nitrates in the River Avon here. But we want to do more. We want to do as much as we possibly can to help create change. Can you see any litter?
Was that a Coke can or something?
It looks like a bottle top or something. And actually, is with all this rain, there'll be a lot more litter that gets washed into the river, sadly.
And I can see maybe a few things just nestling in the reeds on the far side.
So sadly, yes.
Okay, next question.
What wildlife have you seen during your survey? Well, during our brief time in the rain here, not much, because anything sensible is taking shelter. But ordinarily, we see lots of wildlife here. Herons, moorhens, coots, the kingfisher, my favourite. And when you're really, really lucky, otters. But none right now, so we just put none?
We just put none.
Okay.
Got to be honest.
Right.
one of the nice things about the Big River Watch is not just the collection of this really important data, it's also just spending a little bit of time by the river, you know, 15 minutes just sort of looking and listening and watching.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's what I love living on the river. It's why I love being on the water. It is tranquil. It is calming. And actually, we could all do with a bit more of that, couldn't we? And I know that citizen science and the data that can be collected can really, really help. But we have to change the way we do business and the way we treat this beautiful and integral part of our landscape, the lifeblood of the land. Noticing the good things in nature can bring sustained and significant improvements in your well-being. Note down three good things that you've noticed by the river today.
This is challenging given the circumstances, but I think this beautiful tree overlooking the water here.
That's a willow, yeah, absolutely.
That's giving me a lot of joy, the way those slowly yellowing leaves are just falling gently into the water. So I'll put that.
And we've got these beautiful wild sort of violet flowers here.
Is there anything you'd like to share before you submit your survey?
What would I like to share? I'm just going to keep it short and to the point. I love this river. Done.
James Lavelle and Emily Knight in the rain. You could hear it throughout that report, couldn't you? It's now 12 minutes to 8 and time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Jasveer Singh from the Faiths Forum for London.
Good morning. I remember talking about Grenfell Tower on Thought for the Day the very morning after the disaster unfolded. I spoke about how my parents would often drive past the prominent tower block when I was younger, and I would imagine who lived there, what their lives would be like. 7 years on, the inquiry concluded with a roll call of the names of each of the people who were tragically killed. The repercussions of the tragedy will be felt for a very long time to come, and the images of the tower block in flames is firmly lodged not just in our national psyche, but also globally. The impact on those who survived cannot be underestimated either. For them, Grenfell was once their home, their sanctuary, their everything. I met one of the survivors through my work as a barrister a couple of years ago. The inquiry had inspired her to study law, and she was doing some work experience with my chambers to learn more about the profession. Her zeal and determination were clear, as were her personal reasons for pursuing a legal career. She wanted to help those in society who needed support and hold other people to account for their actions. In the early 18th century, the 10th Sikh Guru, Guru Gobind Singh, was engaged in a conflict with the forces of the Mughal Emperor. The Guru lost almost everything. Forced to leave his home, he became separated from his family and his disciples, and his four sons were killed. The older two died in battle, while the younger two were bricked up alive and left to die. He spent days wandering alone in the jungle before being found by two devout Muslims who helped him travel to safety. The Guru then sent a letter known as the Zafarnama to the Mughal Emperor. It reprimanded the Emperor for his behaviour and condemned him for his deceit and dishonesty. It was a bold move by the Guru to speak truth to power in that way, and it was a damning indictment of the Mughal Emperor's cruel regime. The emperor expressed remorse in his response, as well as a willingness to bring people to justice, but he died before he could meet the Guru to seek forgiveness. The Grenfell inquiry has been one way of calling out truth to power. However, with our thoughts now turning to the criminal prosecutions, we also need to think about how to prevent such injustices from ever happening in the future. People need to be held accountable for their actions from the outset, not just when tragedy unfortunately hits. The final report described an unedifying merry-go-round of buck passing when it came to who should have been responsible for ensuring building safety standards. It's high time for the buck to stop with someone, somewhere, long before anyone is killed again.
That was Thought for the Day. The time now is 9 minutes to 8.
Journalists report from wars. It is how, over generations, information has been gathered, information that is independent, separate from, and may contradict the official account. From Churchill in Cuba and Sudan in the late 19th century through countless examples since, this is part of what news organisations do. Not in Gaza, A UN leader has now said Philippe Lazzarini, head of the UNRWA agency, has called for news organisations to exert more pressure to get access to Gaza, 11 months into a war that Israel has banned journalists entering Gaza to report on, apart from limited trips with its soldiers. Gaza also has a border with Egypt. Reporters Without Borders has accused the Egyptian government of a double game, accusing the international media of a pro-Israeli bias on one hand, while assisting Israel's reporting blockade. Christiane Amanpour is CNN's chief international anchor and a veteran herself of many wars. Indeed, she's covering one right now as she joins us from Dnipro in Ukraine. Good morning, Christiane.
Good morning, Michelle.
In your experience, how unusual is this situation where we've now had 11 months of a whole area which people cannot leave, Palestinians from Gaza, I mean, for the most part can't leave, which is inaccessible to journalists from outside?
In my experience, it's not just unusual, it's unprecedented for a country that calls itself the leading democracy in that region. And I think that's the key. Of course, we've been to places which are authoritarian or dictatorships, which do not allow us access. But in our memory, every time we've been able to go to Israel, generally we have access. And in fact, here in Dnipro and in Kyiv and in Kharkiv and all the places that I've been over this last week, we have a lot more access. And this country has been a democracy for far longer than Israel has. And it's very interesting to be able to see the difference in what we're able to tell because of the access that we're able to get. I just ran into my colleague from NBC, chief correspondent Richard Engel, and I told him I was going to talk to you. And I said to him, what is your experience recently in Israel? And he said, you know, it is shocking. We have tried so many times, as you know, many of us, Michelle, many in the international press have signed letters and have tried to, you know, put our case forward to the Israeli government. He said also that it gets worse in the Gaza theater. It's got worse in the you know, with each and every military operation. And this one is terrible. And that's not to say that we are not enormously grateful, humbled and beholden to the exceptional Gaza journalists who are risking their lives, not just being there, but are giving or sending out the information as much as they can for then many of us to be able to take their work, hopefully crediting them as they are due and sending it out to the public.
That information, it is easier, though, isn't it, for the Israeli government to attack it because it comes out of an area that is that Hamas has governed for a long time. When I asked a spokesman for the Israeli government myself on this program not long ago about these restrictions, he said this is a war zone. We're trying to get our hostages out and we will do nothing whatsoever to jeopardize the safety of our hostages. If journalists are there, that makes the situation even more complicated.
Well, I'm not sure what he's talking about, frankly. You know, ever since time immemorial, journalists have been covering wars. We understand what it takes. We understand various rules of engagement, and we understand how to operate in these areas. To your point about Gaza journalists, that is the absolute tragedy, that because they are journalists inside Gaza, because they are, for the most part, Gazans, Palestinians, then Israel and its allies have been able to cast aspersions on what they report. And that is incredibly unfair, incredibly, you know, wrong. And again, we are now beholden and dependent on their incredibly important and brave work. It is not a solution. We are journalists who represent democracies around the world, not least journalists who represent key allies of Israel, without whom it would not have the, you know, the economic or military might that it has. And at the very least, we should be able to represent our constituents around the world in our own countries by telling them what is going on and how an ally is conducting itself in a war zone. And I do think that there's no excuse for this whatsoever. I mean, we've been, as I say, covering wars, some incredibly day. I mean, here we are in Ukraine. There are ballistic missiles being thrown around here at random and at will. We're still covering it. Yeah. There are cruise missiles. There's F-16s bombing us. I mean, hello.
Yeah, and I know you just talked to the commander in chief of Ukraine as part of your coverage. There was a letter that was sent by broadcasters and news organisations to the Israeli government in July, including CNN, including the BBC and the American networks, which requested that Israel uphold its commitments to press freedom. Philippe Lazzarini clearly thinks it is time for more to be done. I wonder what you think that, whether what more is required, some kind of protest or reduction of cooperation or presence in Israel, where which is, you know, the headquarters in the region for many organizations.
Well, look, with due respect, we don't obviously take our marching orders from anybody, the UN or anybody. However, we have already done this. It was our initiative, as you mentioned. It was us, the, you know, a huge selection of the world's independent press who decided to write this letter. And then our bosses supported us. And we've heard absolutely nothing back that would enable us to actually cover a war in the way that we have been used to covering, not just in Gaza and on the West Bank, where the restrictions are heavy, but in the past we've been able to do it, but wherever it might be. And I don't know. I don't know whether there is any leverage whatsoever, because they are, you know, they control the borders, and that's that. And the agreement that Israel has with Egypt also requires an amount of border control. So it's incredibly difficult. And we just hope that at some point this will crack. And certainly there is... there is a case to be made for redoubling our efforts at petitioning the Israeli government. Again, it's unacceptable, it's unprecedented, and it raises the question, why? Why not? Why?
Christiane Amanpour of CNN, thank you.
Coming up to 2 minutes to eight, time for the weather. Here's Steph Dennis.
Thanks very much. Good morning to you. Well, it's going to be another thundery day across southern England, South Wales, the South Midlands. We've got a warning for rain, yellow warning for rain from the Met Office for southern England and South East Wales throughout the day today. So this could cause some issues, some localised flooding in places. But as you drift further northwards, there's plenty of dry weather around pretty much for the rest of the country. We will see some low cloud and some extensive fog affecting parts of eastern England and eastern Scotland, but the rest of northern England and Scotland will be dry with plenty of sunshine. Same too for Northern Ireland, feeling warm and humid.
Thank you very much, Stav. Any questions is tonight. James Cook will be presenting. Morning, James.
Good morning. This week we're broadcasting from Blackpool's famous Winter Gardens. On the panel for Labour, the Leader of the House of Commons, Lucy Powell, the Shadow Attorney General, Sir Jeremy Wright of the Conservatives, Paul Novak, who is General Secretary of the Trades Union Congress, and Baroness Claire Fox, Director of the Academy of Ideas, which organises public debates. The questions, of course, up to the audience, but there's plenty to discuss this week, from the Grenfell inquiry to small boats, to whether or not a four-day week might be a good idea. That's Any Questions, live at 8 p.m. tonight, here on BBC Radio 4.
Thanks, James. Coming up, can the boats be stopped? Can the gangs be smashed?
They are getting bigger. I mean, the boats have been, you know, carrying sort of 60, 70, even 80 people. And they're large 10-metre dinghies now, as opposed to before, the last few years, they were a bit smaller.
We'll be hearing from the Home Office Minister and eyewitnesses on the Kent coast ahead of an important government summit on stopping the problem in the Channel. Plus Jamie Cullum on judging the Mercury Prize.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussein. It's 8 o'clock on Friday, the 6th of September. The headlines this morning: the Home Secretary, who's meeting police and intelligence officials, has spoken of a moral imperative to dismantle the people smuggling gangs behind small boat crossings. Climate scientists say the world has just experienced the hottest June and August ever recorded. And how Northumberland's puffins have bounced back from bird flu. The BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The Home Secretary Yvette Cooper will chair a meeting of senior ministers, intelligence agencies and law enforcement bodies today to discuss what progress has been made in tackling criminal gangs who smuggle people across the Channel. 12 people died on Tuesday when their small boat came apart off the French coast. Ms. Cooper said this showed the moral imperative of dismantling the gangs. Our Home Editor Mark Easton reports.
More than 7,000 migrants have arrived in Britain after attempting to cross the Channel in small boats since the election. But the government believes progress is being made in disrupting the gangs which organise the crossings. The Home Office says the tragedy off the French coast on Tuesday is evidence that the business model of the smugglers is under pressure. More people are being crammed into less seaworthy vessels, with intelligence suggesting the gangs have increased their charges, including demanding payment for children. Ms. Cooper will today highlight significant seizures of boats and equipment in the last 2 months and 70 ongoing investigations, including an operation in Libya in which warehouses holding migrants were raided. However, after promising the rapid recruitment of a border security commander to oversee the response 2 months ago, Downing Street has said the appointment will be confirmed in the next few weeks.
In Germany, the government's migration commissioner has proposed deporting migrants who arrive in the EU illegally from Belarus to Rwanda. Joachim Stamp said the system could work under the supervision of the United Nations. Labour ditched the previous government's Rwanda policy. The former Director General of the UK's Border Force, Tony Smith, told us he wanted it brought back.
We need to be able to make it clear to migrants in France, who are after all already in a safe country, that actually it won't work getting in a small boat. You won't get to stay in the UK. Rwanda was, I think, a very bold attempt to say that those nationals who are already in safe countries are still saying they fear persecution back home, won't be sent back home, actually. There is an alternative, and that is Rwanda, and that would send the deterrent message across.
The European Union's climate monitor Copernicus says that in the past 3 months, the world has experienced the highest temperatures ever recorded for the Northern Hemisphere summer. As well as the hottest June and August on record, the period saw the hottest day, making it increasingly likely that 2024 would break the record for the hottest year. Carlo Bontempo is the director of Copernicus. He said human-driven climate change was the main cause.
What we are seeing is not just a random fluctuation. It's not an oddity of climate that may be due to a strange combination of one of the many factors that affect the climate on this planet. But it's really there is a disproportional effect that is induced by this long-term accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
A former boss at a cladding company who is heavily criticised in the Grenfell Tower inquiry has denied playing a part in the disaster. Claude Verla, who worked at Arconic, refused to give evidence in person to the inquiry, but his name appears in its report more than 100 times. The details from Tom Simons.
Claude Verla was head of the technical sales support team at the manufacturer Arconic. The inquiry report said he resorted to deliberate dishonesty to sell its Rayner Bond cladding, including to firms in the UK. He had emailed colleagues in 2010 saying the product would not meet European fire standards for tall buildings, adding, "We have to keep as very confidential." Near his home in eastern France, he was asked by BBC News to give his reaction to the inquiry's report. He called the deaths of 72 Grenfell victims a tragedy and more than a pity, but he said he was not the one making the decisions about the sales of flammable Rayner Bond PE cladding.
President Zelensky will press Ukraine's allies for more military support when he attends a meeting at Ramstein Air Base in Germany this morning. He's been appealing for permission to strike inside Russia with long-range missiles after Russia stepped up its aerial attacks in recent weeks. Britain has said it will send a further 650 shorter-range defensive missiles as part of a new package of military aid worth £160 million. Professor Michael Clark is a former director of the defence think tank, the Royal United Services Institute. He told us the British missiles were just a fraction of what Ukraine needed.
They need more of everything at the moment, and hundreds of missiles certainly helps, but the speed with which they're being used up means that they'll be exhausted within, you know, a couple of months, one would imagine, given the intensity of Russian advances and the bombardment which the Russians are meting out to Ukraine at the moment.
The Children's Commissioner for England has called for mandatory background checks for private tutors after BBC News found that more than 90 of them had been convicted of sex offences against children over the last 20 years. There's no legal duty for private tutors to have a criminal record check. 30% of secondary school pupils in the UK are thought to have used them. Angus Crawford reports.
There are thought to be more than 100,000 private tutors working in the UK, many giving one-to-one tuition in their own homes. The vast majority are highly professional, but there is no legal obligation on people offering tutoring to undergo criminal records checks. That means under the current system, a teacher struck off for misconduct could offer lessons privately. A BBC investigation found 92 tutors have been convicted of sexual crimes involving children over the last 20 years. The Children's Commissioner for England called the situation shocking and said she wanted mandatory background checks to be introduced for anyone giving private lessons. The government said the findings were deeply concerning and it was looking at what further action it could take to protect children.
At least 17 children have died in a fire at a school in central Kenya. Local media quoting police said another 14 students were hurt in the fire in a dormitory at Nyeri. The cause of the fire is not clear. The co-leaders of the Green Party of England and Wales will promise to counter what they say is Labour's message of doom and gloom at the party's conference in Manchester today. Carla Denyer and Adrian Ramsey said they will push the government to be braver and bolder. They're calling for a wealth tax and a stricter windfall tax on fossil fuels. From Manchester, here's our political correspondent, Harry Farley.
There will be a celebratory mood as the Green Party faithful gather for their conference. 2 months ago, they had their strongest general election result. With four MPs and nearly 7% of the vote, the Greens won seats off both Labour and the Conservatives. They also say they've seen a growth in membership since the start of the year, up from 53,000 to 59,000. But with this comes challenges. How to maintain and build on their new coalition of voters in both Tory shires like Waveney Valley and student hubs like Bristol, and how to move from a largely volunteer-run group to a more professional political party that hopes to challenge Labour from the left.
The Halifax says the average price of a house in the UK hit a two-year high in August. The lender estimates the typical property cost £292,505 last month, a rise of 4.3% compared with the year before. The explorer Dwayne Fields, the first black Briton to walk to the North Pole, has been named as the UK's new chief scout. He'll replace Bear Grylls, who's standing down after 15 years. Dwayne Fields was born in Jamaica and grew up in inner city London and credits being a scout with shaping his life. He told us that far from promoting old fashioned ideas, scouting gave young people the skills they needed in the modern world.
We still need the skills of communication. We still need leadership. We still need to build our self-confidence and our self-belief. Scouting provides all of that. There is an element of woggles and campfires and neckers to it. And I think that's the fun side. But the truth is, scouting provides a place for so many young people.
The National Trust says the puffin population off the Northumberland coast has increased despite the impact of bird flu. The outbreak and the COVID pandemic had stopped rangers on the Farne Islands getting close enough to carry out a full count, but the latest census suggests numbers are up by 15%. Our North of England correspondent Fiona Trott watched the puffin tally.
Metre by metre, rangers on the Farne Islands spent 6 weeks on their hands and knees checking burrows for breeding pairs. It was hard but important work. More than 900 puffins died during the avian flu outbreak, and there were concerns about the impact as the endangered species female lays just one egg a year. But the first full census for 5 years suggests there are now 50,000 pairs across the farms. Rangers believe their quirky behaviour may have protected most of them from bird flu. The seabirds are naturally self-distancing and keep their burrows clean.
That was Fiona Trott on the Farne Islands.
Thank you, Alan. It is now 8:10. It is a moral imperative to destroy the people smuggling gangs, the Home Secretary says. But is it an achievable objective? Or is it one of those things politicians feel they have to say, like pledging to end the trade in drugs? This week, it looks likely that more than 1,000 people will successfully cross the channel. This in a week when 12 died trying. The bottom of their flimsy inflatable gave way. Too many people had been crammed on board. It is not the only boat to have broken up this week. As Matt Coker, a fisherman on the French coast, told us, he's seen several boats making the crossing since the start of the week.
They are getting bigger. I mean, the boats have been, you know, carrying sort of 60, 70, even 80 people. And they're large 10-metre dinghies now, as opposed to before, the last few years, they were a bit smaller. On Monday, when we was out, it was quite a windy, rough day. And I was very surprised to even hear one was coming across. And then when it got within about 2 miles of us, we could see it in the distance. I heard a mayday put out on the radio from a Border Force vessel saying that the dinghy had broke up and there was over 50 people in the water.
Why, you might wonder, are people willing to take the risk? After all, 42 people have died in the Channel so far this year. The answer may be that 22,000 have made the journey safely. For desperate people, those are odds that might be acceptable. The new government is appointing a new border security commander to help with this task. What the job is not as yet clear. We heard from Tony Smith earlier in the programme, a former head of UK Border Force.
We had a Channel Threat Commander under the previous government whose role was certainly upstream disruption as well. And we know that didn't stop the boats in the end. And I think that is the point, is that this is a very lucrative business for the smugglers. And, you know, putting a smuggling gang out of business, there's usually another one waiting in the wings because the money is there. It's a bit like whack-a-mole, really. So you do need a very concerted international attempt, both in Europe and beyond.
Listening to that, joining us from Westminster this morning, Dame Angela Eagle, Minister of State at the Home Office, who has this difficult job. Good morning to you and thank you for joining us.
Morning.
We hear those words, moral imperative. Is it not like the language about the drugs trade? Easy to say, no chance of actually delivering it.
Well, I think that any state has got to ensure that criminal gangs who are profiting on human misery are tackled, disrupted, dealt with, put out of business. And if you have to put one out of business and another one springs up, you have to spend your time having a go at that one as well. Just because something is very, very difficult to do, complex to do, something that you have to do by cooperation across borders, by a lot of communication along these supply chains of misery and exploitation, that doesn't mean to say you shouldn't be doing it. And that is what today's summit is about, really. How can we focus all of our effort in this area? And we're talking about the security services, we're talking about the National Crime Agency, we're talking about people at the highest levels of government focusing across the piece, not in silos, but working together on what is a very, very complex and difficult problem.
And you're appointing someone new to head this up, a border security commander. Now, you heard the challenge there from Tony Smith, who used to be head of UK Border Force. He said, well, look, we've had somebody with a big job title, Channel Threat Commander, under the Conservative government. You've just got a different title, Border Security Commander. Yeah, well, how's it different?
Well, firstly, we're going to be having legislation later in the year to give explicit new powers. We're going to be making sure that we coordinate, as I said, at the highest level across the whole piece of government, but internationally with our partners too. And for example, we've revealed today that there are 70 different investigations going on across the globe dealing with some of this disruption. We don't always talk about what's going on because by definition it's intelligence led.
Sure, but one thing you have talked about is some success in frustrating the trade in boats. They often come from Turkey, they go through Germany, Belgium, France and so on. Now, we were told this week by the Home Office that it is because you've intercepted some of these boats that the gangs are responding by cramming more and more people onto the boats they've still got. And one consequence of that is that the boats then collapse. The bottom falls out of them. People go into the sea. Do we have to accept there may be awful consequences of interrupting the gangs? There may occasionally be fatal consequences of it.
I mean, the fatalities in the Channel this week were absolutely heartrending. Only 8 people on that boat had any kind of a life jacket going across one of the busiest sea lanes in the world. It's obviously very, very, very dangerous.
Sure, but is there a link, Dame Angela? Because you see, when you talk about a moral choice, which is the priority? Some people would say save every life on the Channel. Others say, actually, there's a bigger moral imperative. Stop the gangs. And there may be, day on day, people who lose their lives as you try and stop the gangs.
The gangs are putting their lives at risk daily. If we were to leave this trade to carry on, it would only get worse. And in many ways, the last government allowed it to become industrialised by not cracking down on it when it began a few years ago.
But do you accept there is a trade-off morally? Greece has had some success. Why? Because it's done something it's been morally condemned for. It's pushed boats out. Italy has had success in the Mediterranean. Why? Because it's ignored people who said, allow humanitarian organisations to pick up everybody up out of the Mediterranean. Well, it's made it harder. It's made it harder, and the consequence is fewer people are trying to make the journey.
Well, look, I hope you're not suggesting that we shouldn't try to rescue people who end up in the water. This international maritime law suggests, regardless of morality, that that's what we should be doing.
No, I'm saying if you have fewer and fewer boats, there'll be more people on boats and more sinkings. That might be a consequence.
But what we have to do is stop the supply of boats in any way we can, to disrupt the financial models, to arrest people, to disrupt the gangs, to make certain that we have communications in the countries where people are fooled into thinking that they will be given safe transit to the UK and a job afterwards, on what the actual realities are. This is a multifaceted effort across a range of levels that we have to do and keep doing to suppress this trade. And
you're going to have to impress your international partners, aren't
you? Yes, of course.
And they say, France's interior ministers, that one of the problems is that people crossing the channel think, in the words of the French interior minister, Gerald Darmanin, that England is an El Dorado, a country where you can work very easily without having a resident permit. Will you tackle that part of the problem as well?
Well, I mean, the irony is, of course, that everyone who claims asylum in the UK actually has biometric identity. And we are cracking down very much on exploitative working practices with raids to fine those who are trying to employ people illegally. So we have to do this at every level. That includes cracking down on exploitative employers in the UK. It includes sending people who fail asylum back, and we've made a big increase in returns in the last 8 weeks. We'll carry on doing that.
Just to be clear about what you mean by the biometrics, in other words, they have a form of ID cards. Now,
yes,
when you were a
minister
in the last Labour government, you were very keen on ID cards. You tried to introduce them, and your boss then, Tony Blair, says, in order to have a plan to control immigration, we need digital ID. Without it, new border controls will not be effective. So why not go the full hog? Have those ID cards.
Well, look, I'm not going to make up our policy on ID cards on the radio with you.
It's an option, though, is it?
Well, I'm not going to say that it is an option at the moment. It's not in our manifesto. I'm here to talk about getting in control of our borders and making certain, Nick, that the people that come in that are chosen and are processed properly, quickly and fairly, so they're returned if they're not asylum seekers.
Well, let's talk about returns.
But also, just before we get onto that we don't tolerate a situation where it's criminal gang members that are deciding who comes across our border. It's intolerable for any state, and we will crack down on it, and that is what today's meeting is about.
Well, let's concentrate on returns then. You heard Tony Smith there from UK Border Force, in the past at least, that's the job he did. He said people need to know that they will be sent away from England if they reach England. Now, you have decided that Rwanda is not the way to do that.
Well, it didn't
you say
work.
It's a gimmick and it's, say it's
it
expensive. But the Germans are now considering looking at it, saying that they might be able to use the facilities that the British taxpayer has paid for a form of processing abroad.
Well, look, let's see what they decide to do. But our experience of the Rwanda scheme is that we took £700 million we paid to the Rwandans in order to persuade four people voluntarily to relocate to Rwanda. And they had geared up the previous government to spend literally billions of pounds attempting to make that scheme work.
Well, where will you
it
send them to?
It wasn't funded.
Sure, if you don't send that, we know you don't like it. You've won the election now. We don't have to keep attacking the Tories.
Thanks for noticing
that. What would
that.
You do? What would you do? Where will you send them?
We will actually do the day job. We will process the nearly 106,000 people that were left in a perma backlog by legislation that didn't. Well, if they qualify for asylum, they'll be integrated in our society in the normal way. If they don't, we will have to send them back to where they came.
Where will you send people who come from war zones like Syria and Afghanistan where you can't send them? If you think they don't qualify to stay here, where will you send them?
What we will do, we never say we won't send people anywhere because issues change and whether it's safe or not changes. There were some of them, if they're from countries that we can't return to immediately, might be given some temporary leave to remain. If the situation stabilises in that country, they then become liable to be returned. That is the way that an asylum system works.
Understood. Do people have to prepare for the fact that because there's mass movement of people right across the world on America's southern border, from Africa to Italy across the Mediterranean, people have to prepare for the fact that we can talk all we like. People will be crossing the channel for years to come, won't they?
Well, if they can cross the channel legally, that's fine. But what we don't want is people smuggling gangs, exploiting people, ripping them off, putting their lives at risk routinely to get them across the channel. That is what we're trying to crack down on. And that is what today's meeting is about.
Finally, if I may, Dame Angela, I don't know whether you had the chance to see it. Your responsibility is not prisons, but you may have seen or heard it. Seema Kotecha, our UK correspondent, was inside Pentonville Prison. Very powerful report showing the pressure in that prison, the violence in that prison, the distress caused to prison officers and prisoners alike. Are you shocked by what you've seen?
I haven't seen the report. It doesn't surprise me. I think that the prison system itself, we have inherited from the last government's neglect, is on the verge of collapse. There's a great deal of pressure in both the criminal justice system and the prison system, which serves absolutely nobody. It doesn't help the safety of the public. It's terrible for those people that are trying to make the system work. And I know that the new ministers over there will be doing all in their power to try and relieve that pressure and move forward in a more positive way.
Dame Angela, your Minister of State at the Home Office, thanks very much for giving us your time.
It's 23 minutes past eight. Public libraries are too important for us all to be left to local government, Lee Child told us this week as he spoke out against the planned closure of the library in Birmingham he depended on as a child.
You speak to any writer, they'll tell you the same thing, that those early years of reading for decades, that's what turns you into a writer. So no book would ever get published if it wasn't for reading early in your life. And the way things were, you know, my parents were lovely people and would buy us books if they could afford it, but that was twice a year, at your birthday and Christmas. And so if you wanted to read anything else ever, you had to go to the library.
Well, from that, Lee Child went on to create Jack Reacher and to sell 100 million books. But BBC analysis has quantified what many listeners will already know, that it's not just Birmingham. More than 180 council-run libraries in the UK have either closed or been handed over to community groups in the last 8 years. We're joined by Richard Ovenden, who leads the Bodleian Libraries at the University of Oxford. It is one of six UK libraries entitled to receive a copy of every book published in the UK and Ireland. And also by Steve Bodie, who's a volunteer at Jordanthorpe Library in Sheffield. Steve, tell us first how you became involved in the library, you and the group that you're part of.
So my first connection with the library was reading a report that the council had decided it needed to close 16 community libraries. I'm part of the church on the community, and we decided to set up a charity to take on running of our local library because there wasn't any other option available at the time. So that was how I first got involved.
And does it means that it is staffed by volunteers, I imagine, but then what happens, like how does the library pay the bills, the gas and electricity bill, or what happens if there's a leak in the roof or it needs refurbishment?
So, yes, we're totally volunteer-run. There are no paid staff at all. And we're responsible under our lease for maintaining the building. So we rely partly from a grant support from the council. But then we have to raise other funds ourselves, either by services we provide or by applying for grant from other organisations and sources.
Do you think it's sustainable? Is it working, or is it always a bit hand-to-mouth?
It has been sustainable. We're just 2 months short of our 10th anniversary running. There are 16 volunteer libraries in Sheffield. And 10 years ago, 16 started out and all 16 are still running. So it is sustainable. But obviously, there are challenges like any charity, and going through the cost of living crisis and everything else, funds can be tight at times.
Richard Ovenden, how do you look at all of this? I wonder what you think the answer is to keeping libraries like the ones that Lee Child was talking to us about and others, keeping them open primarily.
Well, I think the responsibility is held by government. It's quite clear in the 1964 Public Libraries and Museums Act that the Secretary of State has a responsibility to provide a comprehensive and efficient library service across the country, and has a responsibility to superintend the system of libraries that come under the auspices of the Act.
The Secretary of State for Culture, you mean?
Yes, absolutely. So in DCMS, that's where the ultimate responsibility lies. And under the 64 Act, it's very, very clear. And I think the government needs to, you know, wake up and smell the coffee about what is happening to libraries, to public libraries in particular. But, you know, libraries in the UK are an ecosystem. And we've seen the British Library's kind of very severe cyber attack last year, which has caused, you know, a great deal of problems for the whole system, not just the BL itself, but for other legal deposit libraries, for public libraries, and, you know, the whole ecosystem of libraries. And I think that the Minister of there is a ministerial responsibility for libraries held within DCMS. That's currently Chris Bryant's, but he has several other briefs. He's also Minister of State for Data Protection and Telecoms, and the Minister of State for Creative Industries, Arts and Tourism. So, you know, he's got three jobs. And if you look at his Wikipedia page, the library responsibility isn't even mentioned.
Yeah.
So I think government needs to take libraries much more seriously. Let's break the ministerial responsibility out and give it a distinct place in government, so that all of the critical issues that public libraries in particular support in our society can be addressed.
I mean, you mean central government, of course, whereas these libraries, of all the ones we're talking about, have been under the auspices of councils. And of course, they have many different things and all kinds of expenses, which are only increasing at a time like this.
And of course, that's absolutely right. Many of the responsibilities have been devolved over recent decades to local government from central government. But that key responsibility to oversee the system and to do that superintendence role, which is still very clear in the Act, rests with central government. So let's have a bit of joined up government. Let's have DCMS work much more closely with local government, and to, you know, to ensure that different parts of the country are able to offer the same standard of service. You know, we have, you know, parts of the country have really excellent, vibrant, running public library services, which are, you know, incredible, but it's not the same picture all over the country. And I think that's where government can play a key role in helping to develop the sector as a whole and lift everyone up, so that we can, you know, really see libraries as infrastructure for democracy, when democracy is, as we know across the world, fragile.
Steve, what do you think of what Richard has said? Or do you think there's a dimension that now exists in the libraries that you're involved with, because they are so close to the community and it's volunteers who really care, who are there day in and day out?
I think having volunteers involved does make a huge difference, because they know the local community and its needs in detail. So across the libraries in Sheffield, obviously we provide books, but we provide much more than books. You know, connection to citizens' advice, other services like adult education, links with the NHS, cinema groups, welcome spaces, story time for preschoolers to get children going as young as possible. Whole range of different services that actually springs from the team of volunteers because they all come with a range of different experiences and skills and interests. And so that breadth means that we can do a huge amount and bring a lot into the community.
Steve Bodie and Richard Ovenden, the Bodleian's librarian, thank you.
It's now 8:30. Time for Gary.
A very good morning to you. Just over 2 hours to go before the third and final test between England and Sri Lanka gets underway at the Oval. Leicestershire's Josh Hull will make his debut. Now, an hour ago, I spoke to the England coach, Brendan McCullum. This time, it's thoughts from a cricket fan. It's former Prime Minister Sir John Major. Sir John Major, we're speaking at the Oval. When did you first come here? What do you remember?
Well, I first came here in the early 1950s. I think it was 52. For the Surrey against Sussex game. I remember thinking how big it was. I had no idea. And I sat there with my scorebook and with my Tizer and with my sandwiches, and I had an idyllic day, and it was the first of many, many visits to this ground over the last 70 years.
What attracted you specifically to the game of cricket?
My sister. My sister taught me to play cricket when I was about three. Pat was 13 years older than me. And she taught me to play up against our garage wall at home in Worcester Park when I was a very small boy. And she then used to take me to Worcester Park Cricket Club every weekend to watch the team play. And I learned later from my elder brother that she was quite interested in two twins who were playing for Worcester Park. The Binney twins, I seem to remember the name. But nothing ever came of that. But certainly she continued to take me to cricket every weekend, and I just fell in love with it.
What have you learned from watching sport? What solace have you found in it, Sir John?
Well, I think what I've learned above all else is that cricket and sport generally, but I think especially cricket, can bring people together in the way very little can. And you find people whose countries are distinctly opposed to one another who can play cricket. The enmities of politics and life are put aside when you're playing cricket with someone. So it's wonderful at bringing people together. That's the first thing I learned about it. As for solace, it's provided me with solace from my youngest years. Whenever I was unhappy or in trouble or just plain worried, it was cricket that would take my mind off whatever was happening. Cricket anywhere, but particularly here at the Oval, because we lived at Brixton. I could walk to the Oval in half an hour and come and sit down and watch some cricket, and it wiped everything else away. Politics, personal, financial, whatever the worry was, it would go while I was watching cricket, and I would return home in a better frame of mind than I arrived.
So the day that you left Downing Street as the Prime Minister, that's why you came here, but did it really wipe everything away? Surely not. It can't have done.
It was a lovely sunny day, yes, it did. Of course, it didn't wipe it out for completely and for good. But while I was here, it took my mind off all the things that had happened. And then we had an extremely nice weekend at home, actually. We had friends there. We had a barbecue. And you just move on. There's no point in looking back.
Did you do that visit, though, on impulse? Did you suddenly say, I'm going to go to the Oval? Or did you think about it?
No, I talked about it before.
Yeah.
I knew I was going to go to the Oval. You go and see the Queen. Theoretically, you hand in the seals of office. You say goodbye to the Queen. What do you do? Go home, twiddle your thumbs. You need to do something that absorbs you. And so I did. I came here to the Oval.
Did you tell the Queen you were coming here?
I think I did.
What did she say?
She smiled. I don't think she was very surprised. She'd heard too many conversations between Prince Philip and I about what the test score was.
You regularly attend matches here. How healthy is the county game?
Well, I am worried about the county game. It's being forced to the fringes of the cricket season by the short form of the game, because the short form is so popular. It's bringing in huge numbers of people, which is very healthy for the game. The vast number of women who previously wouldn't have watched cricket. So it's doing a great deal for the finances of the game and keeping cricket alive. But I worry that the county game is the natural route to Test cricket. And I worry, too, about the future of Test cricket. I hope for the rest of my life we're going to be seeing Test cricket.
Elaborate on why you worry about Test cricket, then.
Because I watch Test cricket on television when it's overseas. When it's here in the UK, you're going to have full grounds. When it's in Australia, you'll have full grounds. When it's in South Africa, you won't. When it's in the West Indies, you certainly won't. The large number of the Test-playing nations simply do not attract large crowds to watch Test cricket, and that is a worrying development.
You've talked about the bonuses of the short ball game, but is it actually damaging then, do you think, the county game?
Well, I think it's damaging the county championship. I mean, the county championship, most of the games were played before midsummer, And then the county championship is suddenly halted for 6 or 8 weeks or 6 weeks while the short form of the game is played and the school holidays are on. And you then go back to the county game. It's not given the priority it used to. Now, that may be financially inevitable, but people like me who've been watching the county game for getting on for 70 years regret that it's happened, even though we rejoice at the support cricket is getting in its new form.
England have announced that Brendan McCullum, who coaches the Test team, is also going to coach the White Ball team. What do you think about Bazball?
Well, I think it's immensely entertaining. I mean, I sometimes wonder if it's Test cricket. And sometimes it seems to me we have thrown away a good position in a game by trying to force it at the wrong time and in the wrong circumstances. But I think we're learning from that. I think we've seen in a couple of games recently that batsmen are prepared to play in what today would be regarded as a rather old-fashioned pace in order to win a game. And I think providing that can be merged with Bazball, splendid. It makes wonderful entertainment. It's vital that we entertain the public.
Have you ever spoken to Brendan McCullum and given him your thoughts?
I wouldn't dream of giving him my thoughts. He has enough in his ear, I would think.
Later today, England play Sri Lanka, and Joe Root is now record century run maker. What do you most admire about his batting?
The pace, the stillness of his body while he's waiting for the ball, the capacity to play bowlers of all sorts and in all sorts of circumstances, and the fact that without noticing it, he's on 20. And you think he's not playing Bazball, but he gets 100 and 110 balls. It's quite remarkable because he makes it look so easy.
If you could choose jobs, being the Prime Minister or an England batsman and scoring a double century, which one would you choose?
Well, in my dreams, I'd undoubtedly choose a double century. In reality, I probably wouldn't, because there are things I wanted to do in politics and some of them I was able to do. I would choose that.
Sir John Major, thank you very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much, Gary, both for today's interview and all the pleasure you've given me with your broadcasting over the last heaven knows how many years. I only have one complaint, which you may take into retirement. Your racing tips are very expensive. They will not be missed.
I can't disagree. Sir John, thank you.
Thank you.
What a lovely interview, Gary.
You're very kind.
For people who have not quite cottoned on to the fact that you might be leaving us, there is one
what?
More day.
What? When did that happen? Let's move on. Test Match Special gets underway at 10:25 p.m. Monday morning. Just underway at the Paralympics, Sarah Storey will be attempting to win her 19th gold medal on a day when 57 gold medals are up for grabs on the ninth day of a competition.
I'm a bit worried, Gary. You're about 8 minutes later than you normally are. Are you going to miss the 9 o'clock, are you?
Oh, I'm going to miss the 9 o'clock, but there is one at 9:15.
It's not too much of a problem.
No, it's not.
Very good.
On this occasion. Thank you, Gary. The reunion is coming up just after nine, and here's Kirsty Walk.
It was a Friday night in a well-known Glasgow bar. A local ska band had just performed on stage. But a police helicopter flying overhead was in trouble. It crashed into the Clutha pub, killing 10 people, including the three crew. Among those who joined the rescue effort was Jim Murphy, who pulled an unknown, unconscious woman from the rubble. He never found out who she was, but on the reunion, he does, and they talk about that night, 13 years ago, for the very first time. They join the pub's owner, fire and ambulance personnel and other survivors for The Reunion, the Clutha helicopter crash, this morning at 9 o'clock.
Thank you, Kirsty. Quick look at the weather now. Today, much of the UK will be dry with periods of sunshine. Spells of rain, heavy and thunder in the southwest will move slowly north into southern Wales and parts of central England.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4, where Alan Smith has the news.
The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, is leading a high-level meeting today to see what progress is being made in taking apart the gangs smuggling migrants across the Channel. She says the deaths this week of 12 people when their boat broke up off France showed the moral imperative of dismantling the crime networks. The Home Office Minister, Dame Angela Eagle, told us the meeting was aimed at focusing efforts to solve a very complex and difficult problem. The EU's climate monitor, Copernicus, says the past 3 months have seen the highest temperatures ever recorded during the Northern Hemisphere summer. The agency said 2024 was increasingly likely to be the hottest year. President Zelensky will call for more military aid when he meets ministers from his country's allies at an air base in Ramstein in Germany today. Britain is expected to announce a further 650 missiles as part of a new package of military support worth £160 million. And the explorer Dwayne Fields, who was born in Jamaica and grew up in inner-city London, has been named the UK's new Chief Scout, replacing Bear Grylls.
Alan, thank you very much. 20 to 9. There's been a big jump in the number of second homes being put up for sale in Pembrokeshire, BBC Wales is reporting today. That's following the county using powers allowed by the Welsh Government to increase council tax on such properties. The tax was increased by 200% on second homes in Pembrokeshire. Other counties have taken similar action amid concerns about homes being unaffordable and unavailable to local people. Professor Sheila Agarwal joins us. She's co-director of the Centre for Coastal Communities at the University of Plymouth. Last summer, summer 2023, I should say, she was a contributor when we had a group of listeners from Tenby in Pembrokeshire editing this programme in an edition that was called Life's Not Always a Beach. And we're also joined by Carol Peat from the consultants West Wales Property Finders. What do you think, Carol, about these figures on the number of second homes being put up for sale?
Oh, it's absolutely appalling. I mean, it's killing the golden goose of tourism, and it's devastating local shops and restaurants and cafes, because these houses are all standing empty rather than being filled with holidaymakers who are spending money in the local economy. I am a local, we're a local farming family, and I'm very invested in letting local people have houses, but this is not the way to go about it. It's just harming the economy and stopping local people getting jobs, basically.
And you're saying this because lots of these properties that are going on the market would have been short-term rentals. People would have used them for a week, or they would have been Airbnbs?
Mainly not Airbnbs, actually. It's proper holiday rentals. Or it's second homes for people like me, for instance, who born and brought up here, went away for work because, you know, for jobs. And then maybe their parents have died or they inherited the house and intend to move back there permanently when work allows. But in the meantime, Jose lets the place so that they can move back into it.
Sheila Agarwal, what do you think of this decision in the first place on council tax and its effect?
I welcome the decision. Nationally, we are facing a coastal housing crisis, and second homes, including Airbnbs and short-term holiday lets, are a huge, huge part of the problem. In many coastal communities, second homes, Airbnbs and short-term holiday lets represent over half of the available accommodation stock, and this is having a devastating impact on local communities. Whilst I acknowledge that tourism is very, very important economic activity in many of these communities, perhaps the most dominant economic activity, its impact, as we know, tends to be highly seasonal, focused on the summer months, maybe a few weeks over Easter and Christmas, and towns are left deserted. Surely having a thriving community, living in a community all year round, is more economically beneficial. You know, I do acknowledge that some second home owners, second homes that they've been in the family for generations, they're used frequently, they're not sublet, and for all intents and purposes are part of the local community. However, for the most part, they are sublet, they're only partially occupied throughout the year.
Yeah. Do you recognise what Carol was saying about shops and businesses, which will rely on business being better because of people coming in the summer months, in particular when the weather is good, enjoying the seaside, and that income then tides them over in the quieter months in the winter?
I do recognise that, but, you know, we live in Britain. The summer season can vary greatly from, you know, from a bad, poor summer, 6 weeks, to, you know, a good summer, maybe 9 weeks. So, you know, It's not a sustainable form of, you know, economic activity to sustain a community. There are also wider impacts of second homes and Airbnbs and short-term holiday lets. To rent, they inflate the cost of rental of accommodation for local people. And if you throw into the mix the rates of mortgages, lack of social housing, what this means is that local people must move out of the area.
Carol, can I ask you, especially given that your business is finding property, can I ask you about prices? The fact that there's so much property suddenly on the market as a result of this, council tax change, are prices lower?
No, frankly, it's a completely different housing market. There are a few houses that are holiday lets that would do as you know, houses for young local people, like the few terraced houses in Tenby. But generally, the market is totally different. Holiday houses tend to be the sort of chocolate box, pretty, lovely cottages, which in reality are dark, damp and horrible to live in the winter. And locals don't want to live in them. Or they're sort of, you know, sea view properties that are £1 million. And there's no way, even if they drop a little bit, that they are going to be affordable by local people. It's ridiculous. I mean, if they want, which we all want, I mean, I have young family trying to get onto the property market too, you know, locals. What they need to do is build new houses near to people's work and schools and things that we have local restrictions for local people only can buy them. They can't be bought as second homes. And the other thing, if they really want to solve the problem, and it's not just a jealousy tax, which frankly I think it is to stop anything under the average price of a house here, which is about 250,000, being sold as a second home, because those are the properties that locals can afford. And if they're not allowed to be sold as second homes, that will bring the price of them down and help local people. But to stop houses of, you know, 750,000 being sold as second homes just means they'll stand empty or be bought by people who can afford to pay the council tax. So it doesn't help at all.
Carol Pete and Professor Sheila Agarwal, thank you both.
It's now 13 minutes to nine. That is the sound of the winners of the Mercury Prize. English Teacher is the name of the band, a Leeds-based indie band, the first act outside London to win the prestigious music prize since 2014 for their debut album, This Could Be Texas. And judges said their album stood out for its originality and character. Amongst those judges, Jamie Cullum. Welcome to the Today programme, Jamie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
What makes them special?
Well, you know, the Mercury Prize is all about awarding prizes to albums, full bodies of work. And I think you've got an album like this from English Teacher, which brings together so many things that are vital about music. It's playful, it's intelligent, it's exciting, it feels fresh. It's got an amazing sense of fun, but you can just listen to the album over and over again and get new and exciting things from it each time. So that's why it won. But I mean, the Mercury Prize as a whole, all of these 12 albums are deemed as winners. And that's one of the wonderful things about it.
Fresh, but also different for the Mercury Prize, not just different in the sound of recent Mercury winners, but also the fact there's not a London-based band. It'd be 9 years, isn't it?
That's true. And I hadn't really thought about that. You know, I think when you're on the panel, you obviously try and make a really balanced list. But so often it's not something at the forefront of your mind half the time. You're really listening in the room with all the judges. The amount of joy speaking about the music is such a wonderful thing. I always say to the artists afterwards, if I get to meet them, you love the way people are talking about your album. It's a real celebration.
Now, the producers in the office, who follow this rather more carefully than I do, said they thought Charlie XCX would win. Popular, brat, her album is big, much more commercial, and of course not a debut album.
Well, I mean, I don't know whether I'd agree that Charlie XCX made a commercial album. It has been commercially successful, but actually it's got loads of really left field stuff within it that is really on the edges of what music is doing. It's also been popular, and Charlie XCX is one of the most amazing pop stars out there at the moment. So yeah, that also would have been a worthy winner. But as I said, these are 12 brilliant albums. So they genuinely are all talked about as winners, but obviously there is one winner. And as the judges, we decided that English Teacher would be a brilliant winner for just showing where British music can go.
Now, I got teased in the office for not knowing some of the bands here. Do you think the Mercury Prize, one of the advantages of this list that you produce is for old duffers like me, it is like a guide to new music. It is a way, and I did it with the Last Dinner Party after they won, it is a way of saying, oh, I'll have a listen to that. Let's sample it, which actually these days is rather harder. Spotify sometimes drives people towards nostalgia choices, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as someone who grew up loving the Mercury Music Prize as a music fan, and, you know, I was someone who was really across music that was coming out because I'm just a music person, I would always look at the Mercury list and go, all right, who do I not know from that list? And there are always people from every year that I go, I haven't heard of this band, I'm going to listen to it. And it's such a crowded landscape in culture, isn't it? You know, any prize that has some kind of prestige that you go, okay, well, if it's on the list, then I'm going to give it my time. And I think that's exactly how I see it. It's a way of discovery for things. Some things are popular that people know, and some things actually people have never heard of. And they might just find their favorite band that are currently playing small gigs in small venues that they can afford a ticket to and go and support these new bands.
And is this album proof that music still has something to say? That, in other words, if people want to communicate how they feel, what they think about the world, it isn't just by posting on social media.
Well, I might be biased, but I think as long as there are human beings on planet Earth, music will always have something to say.
A good place to end. Jamie Cullen, thanks so much for joining us.
9 minutes to 9, a full count of puffins on the Farne Islands off Northumberland, possible for the first time in 5 years because it was delayed by COVID and bird flu, has revealed, happily, that numbers are up. The population is stable, the National Trust says, and it seems that the puffins' behaviour helped protect them. Our North of England correspondent Fiona Trott reports.
All right, so let's start point. Yeah, start point can be here.
Using a bamboo stick and a piece of rope, the puffin census begins. It's painstaking work.
This one looks very occupied. There's lots of fresh droppings in there. This one's also occupied, a bit of eggshell and feather as well.
In sunshine, wind and rain, rangers on the Farne Islands use the rope to measure a sample area of 5 square metres. They then get down on their hands and knees to count the occupied burrows inside it. All this takes 6 weeks. And now the results are in.
It's gone up by 15%, which means the population is stable.
Sophia Jackson is the National Trust's area ranger for the Farne Islands.
I think all the rangers are super happy. You're sort of proud because you've looked after them and done all the work.
You must be so relieved.
So relieved, because they are such characters as well, and you do become attached to them. You just do, every single one of them.
The truth is, the rangers just didn't know what to expect. They started an annual count back in 2018, but the pandemic and then bird flu brought it to a halt. At that point, the only way of monitoring puffin numbers was the heartbreaking exercise of picking up their carcasses. Over 900 were collected. But now they've learned something new. The puffins' quirky behaviour might actually have saved some of them.
The puffins nest in burrows, so separate nests. They'll come back to usually the same burrow each year. They'll clean it out, so they're quite hygienic under the soil. You'll see lots of soil and debris being sort of kicked out in the spring, so they'll make it lovely in there. So they do keep themselves in that way, so disease is less likely to spread as fast as it does through the other seabirds, which is why we saw the decline in them.
The team thinks another reason for the numbers holding up could be the weather. There have been less named storms, which means grey seals haven't gone further up onto some of the islands, damaging puffin burrows in the process. And the absence of storms during breeding season meant the puffins could carry on fishing for sand eels and didn't starve. Around these remote islands, all life is fragile. Ranger Tom Hendry explains why the puffin count helps them understand what's happening with the wider environment.
The puffins, like all the seabirds we have here on the Farne Islands, so they're very indicative of the health of our seas, the state of our environment. If there's anything wrong with the seas, then the seabirds, they'll be the first to suffer. So it's really important that we have an idea of just how many we have.
Today's results also include an estimate of how other species have fared over the past year. It's thought the shag population may have decreased by 75% because of bird flu. But rangers believe they've had a productive breeding season and hope next year's count will show that, like the puffins, they too have stabilised. In the meantime, Sophia says work continues to make the habitat as welcoming as they can.
When the pufflings leave, we've got to cut puffin runs through the vegetation, so we cut all the vegetation so they can leave out to the sea.
Like a little landing strip.
Like a little landing strip, yeah. So you do feel really responsible for the protecting of the seabirds. So when it is positive, you are proud that you've been part of protecting that colony.
The ambition now is to monitor the puffins every single year. Known as the clowns of the sea, these colourful characters entertain us but can teach us so much more.
Fiona Trott reporting there. It's now 5-9. The last time England played San Marino, the score, remember anybody? 10-0. The tiny republic surrounded by Italy has in fact never won a competitive football match. Until now. 34 years after they played their first qualifier. No wonder the stadium announcer sounded just a little excited after the final whistle.
San Marino! Uno! Biggest time! Zero! San Marino! Uno! Biggest time!
Yes, it was San Marino 1, Liechtenstein 0. And watching, the football correspondent for Sport Italia, Tancredi Palmer, joins us on the line. Were you as excited as all that, Tancredi?
Buongiorno from Italy. Well, as excited as them, impossible, to be honest. But when, you know, nobody was really watching the San Marino game yesterday, although the football nerds, when they saw in the schedule that there was San Marino Liechtenstein, they thought, maybe finally something could happen because the Nations League formula could help also the little, very little teams.
And just to be clear, this is not a team of players on €300,000 a week.
Well, this is not even a team of players sometimes because many of them, they have a second job that actually are their first job, who works in industries, who works in offices. So this is... I don't want to sound disrespectful, but it is like sometimes when in a pub leagues you have people that have other works and they also play for the team. And this is what is happening most of the times with San Marino. And for example, for Liechtenstein, not always is happening the same. Some years ago, Liechtenstein has a forward that was playing in Serie A. For San Marino, it's different. And also, you heard that excitement, but don't think that there were more than 1,000 people in the stadium. Because
1,000, it's not quite the San Siro in Milan.
No. That is the capacity of the stadium. I have played in that stadium, and I was not a football player. I played in the stadium when I was in a under-14 team. I said, wow, I played in the San Marino Stadium. But this is what we are talking about then, along the night, because, you know, it is possible for football fans now with simulcast, with multicast, to watch all the games of the night together. And normally, San Marino, they would only go there and say, okay, the other team scored 6-0, 7-0. And along the night, what was fun was that the attention that would be for a bigger teams, Serbia, whatever, the attention just directed into the game, saying when San Marino scored, and then really they can do it, really after 20 years, really the first competitive game. So in some ways it became a social media event because, you know, nobody was watching, but then everybody knew through Twitter, and then everybody wanted to know let me know what's happening in the end.
Just a few seconds to go, I'm afraid, but does that mean the nation will tune in for the match against Gibraltar?
Well, for sure. Also because the formula of Nations League is helping even to have this dream to being promoted to the next Nations League division. And, you know, going from 20 years without winning a single game until aiming to be promoted in the next division is...